last time we were discussing in the ashram, then the aspect of the first thing is training. Because in the overall scheme, there is to learn, then one must hear, then one must contemplate and practice, and from that practice and contemplation, then one gets realization. And then, from that realization, naturally, then one is able to teach. When one gets realization, then one actually practices that that is their own. It's one's own understanding, one's own values, one's own life. So, that aspect is there. Jai Ho Maharaj. So then, we see that on all levels this will be going on. Means that when we are hearing about the first basic knowledge, there must be also the discussion, some discussion just to understand the basic fundamentals. So there must be some contemplation, some understanding, and then where some we gain that. Then on the broader level, then, you know, and then we decide, yes, this subject we value, we want to study and go deeper into it. Right, but it's still, it's fairly superficial. We're just dealing with the basic concepts and the vocabularies and these kind of things. Then the next stage is that in the span of the student in his studies, then you will be studying, you'll be hearing, then there'll be the practice of that, and then at the end, by the during and by the end of the study, then there'll be deepening of the understandings to the point where the values become manifest. Right? The realization will be there. Then we see that then the next phase of that is that student life is where we are hearing. Then after that, then we are practicing it and contemplating it deeper. And then after that, then we see Vanaprastha Sannyas, then that is the deep realization of that after a lifetime of studying and practicing. So we see that this is happening on within the subject, learning the subject itself, within this time of being a student and within the lifetime. So it's always the same principle is working. The same aspects are working. So then, so the important thing is the student life is that's where we are able to hear the most. We have the time to hear and absorb. That's what it's for. So the mind must be peaceful at that time. It should not be distracted. We are not distracted by economic development. We are not distracted by the interaction between, you know, the men and the women. All these aspects we try to avoid. Because any of these then bring up aspects that one must distract one's mind from study. Because you have to get down into practical application outside of the education. Right? To make money, you must contemplate, understand the situations and endeavor for that. Boys and girls, their interaction, that takes work. You know, you have to endeavor, you have to think about that. You have to dress nicely, always be at the right place at the right time, say all the right things. It's a problem. So it distracts the mind. So then in the Vedic culture, during the student life, these things would be avoided. Then after study, then those who would who had a deep understanding, means what the understanding that one would gain from a lifetime, you know, being spent or time being spent in the Grihastha Ashram and in worldly activities. So one gains that by hearing and the application of it in the ashram. Then one does not need to move into marriage. And then for those who understand, then they will, how you say? They will apply this. I mean, they'll take this knowledge and apply it in the Grihastha Ashram. That's the Upakurvana. Then, after marriage, then we have the Grihastha, and then they continue this platform. This is known as the Grihastha Brahmachari. Right? The, according to the scripture that Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavad Gita, that someone who approaches his wife only for the purpose of having children in a planned way, this is still considered brahmacharya. So that is called the grihastha brahmacharya. So that means how much interest there is in children, that much there's that association. So that is also considered brahmacharya. So that's grihastha brahmacharya. Because the principle is that if you control the senses, then you can detach oneself from the senses. If you can't control the senses, then it just grows. It's like a fire. It just grows and grows. But if one controls, then one, by that restricting, you can change habit. Right? Conditioned nature means habit. That's all we're dealing with. The conditioned nature, we have been eating, sleeping, mating, defending since time immemorial. And we have the habit of doing that. So now, if we want to change those habits, then that is also by practice. Right? It's like eating. We have a lot of practice of eating. Right? Generally once, twice, three times, you know. Or when I was in Hong Kong, I was told that the local custom there is they eat six times a day. Like that. A little bit, six times a day. You know, there's some communities in Gujarat, they never actually eat a meal. They just snack all day. So every 45 minutes, they eat a little something. Like that. So 15, 20 times a day, they eat. So practice is there for eating. So we like to eat. So it'll take some practice to now learn how to eat prasadam. You know, that you're not just thinking something that just tastes good, or overeating so much, you know, or, you know, dealing very roughly. But one must learn to practice properly, you know, eat those things Krishna likes, offer them to Krishna. Eat in the proper consciousness, you know, eat the proper amount. So it takes time. But when we understand, we start. We hear, we should take prasad. Then we practice that. And that, like this, slowly, slowly, then we develop very nicely. So that works very well. So the practice must be there. So practice means there must be some regiment, right? You call it practice when something's being done regular in a systematic way. Otherwise, it's not called practice. You say occasionally you do something. But something's called practice because you do it regularly, right? There's some system. You have some idea. It may be well-developed, maybe not well-developed. But some system is there. Then you call it practice. So this is the whole purpose of the Varnashram system, is that you practice those things that are going to change one's habits of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending to something in line with Krishna. Right? Something that's connected to Krishna. It means Krishna has created the material world, and it is his place. It belongs to him. So then we practice how to use this in his service. We have for so long practiced using it not in his service. So now we practice how to use it in his service. So to make sure that we use it in his service, then we have to have some standard. So Krishna very kindly gives us those standards. He gives us the proper method of chanting the holy name, the devotional process. He gives us the pancharatra, how to worship him in the form of the deity, and all the rules and regulations that go along with that. Then he gives us the Vedic culture, which then we are able to use in his service. So he gives all this. And then by following these things, this is the practice that can bring us then to doing everything for Krishna. In the beginning, then eating, sleeping, mating, defending, we may have to engage all those. Krishna gives how to do all that, right? And everything, you know, that supports that. Right? So then we practice all that. Then with time we may see defending gets less, right? We see we may depend more on Krishna, whatever he arranges. So then we may keep a lot of facilities, a lot of different things, you know. Maybe no also, you know, martial arts, or we have our weaponries or different things. It's with time we see, at least for ourselves personally, these things may be less, more dependent upon the Lord, more dependent upon how he establishes things. Right? For others, that's another thing. We're talking, the discussions we're having now are for the individual. We're not talking overall, right? We're talking individual. So then with time we might find, okay, then the mating aspect becomes less, you know, instead of so many children, maybe less children, right? Like this. Meenzi mentions during the wedding ceremony, and one of the things in Panigrahana is where the husband holds the wife's hand and gives various, you know, benedictions and instructions. Then one of them is, may there be 11 men in the house, right? That means there's the husband and 10 sons. So that aspect is there. At the same time, we see in the story of Vyasadeva, when he was, how do you say? What happened to his brother? Oh yeah, Vichitravirya. I think it was Vichitravirya? Yeah. So then he was unable to produce any children. And so the dynasty would be lost. And then, what was her name? I know her, Matsyaganda. Satyavati. Satyavati, yeah. When she was young, she was known as Matsyaganda because she was a fisherman's daughter and she had this wonderful attribute that her body smelled like a fish. So she was known as Matsyaganda. Later on, she got the blessing and she didn't smell like a fish. Then she was known as Satyavati. So she was worried. She was Vyasadeva's mother. And whenever Vyasadeva gave her the benediction, whenever she wanted him, she just had to think of him, he would come. So then she thought of him, he came. And she said, according to the rules, you know, that applied in Satya, Treta, and Dvapara, doesn't apply in the Kali Yuga, that if the husband, something, he died or was unable to have children, the husband's brother, then could produce children in the womb of his wife. So then Vyasadeva was called, and this was explained that Vichitravirya has no issues, so the Kuru dynasty will be finished. So then he agreed, and then his two wives, Amba, Ambalika, then they came forward. But Vyasadeva is a hermit. He doesn't keep himself very well. Just by nature, his skin is like a steel gray color, right? You know, it's not really wonderful, you know. You could imagine having a husband whose skin was the color of, like, not very well maintained stainless steel or something. You know, it's not overly attractive. So, you know, he has that color, matted hair, you know, his deer skin, beard, not very well kept, you know, not finely manicured like the Kshatriya princes would be. You know, so it's not exactly the ideal of what the romantic Kshatriya, you know, princess would be looking for. So then one of them closed her eyes because it was just too far out. So her child was blind. because her consciousness was like that. Then the other one, she was just so afraid. She was terrified because Vyasadeva was very powerful. So she was just afraid. And so then she became pale. So Pandu, her son, was white. And then, you know, the two queens were, you know, not overly interested in any more of this. So then they brought in the maidservant. And the maidservant was very respectful and everything, because she was not proud that she was, you know, a great princess and all this like that. So then, because of the respect, then she gave birth to Vidura, who was a great devotee and, you know, Mahabhagavan. But Satyavati was not satisfied. You know, here we have a blind man, we have a someone who has Pandu, means that just, there's, you know, no color. Very sickly. Like that. And then we have a Shudrani, I mean a how you say, what's it called? Means the children born of the maidservants, then, because the maidservants aren't the queen, they're the assistants of the queen. Their children have all royal facility. They're taken care of. But they don't have, they can't sit on the throne. They don't have that position. So then she was thinking, you know, this is not good enough. You know, we need some more strong personality for the king. So she approached Vyasadeva and said, "You please try again with one of the queens." And he said, "No, according to Shastra, someone who's very serious about spiritual life only approaches his wife three times." Right? Like this. And then Satyavati said, "Okay, we'll make do with what we have." And then he left. So this is then the next step down. Okay, from the standard of 10 children, then we bring down to this. Few. 1, 2, 3. Then with time we may find that comes to the point it's not necessary anymore. Right? Then we're down to just eating and sleeping. And then as we see, as we become more absorbed in Krishna consciousness, more advanced, more detached, even the eating and sleeping goes down. You know, it's recommended that the saintly person, the sannyasi, only eats once a day. So eating, in this definition, means grains. So that means you take some milk, some fruit, something another time, that's not considered eating. You know, like we see, Srila Prabhupada in the morning would take fruit, milk, sweets, maybe a little something, you know, like that, one samosa, one kachori, something just, because according to Ayurveda, one should not only eat sweet in the morning and take sweet at lunch, otherwise one can get diabetes. So the morning there must be something salty if you're going to take sweet at lunch. Lunch you're not taking sweet, then it doesn't matter. But generally, you know, it's considered cultured, sweets are there at all the meals. So then, because the six tastes are all good for the body. So then, that's not considered eating. Nighttime you take some milk, you know, take some fruit, like that. So once a day one is taking some solid food, so that's there. Or one may cut it down to you only actually eat once, right? And then sleeping, Prabhupada's recommending that is cut back as much as possible. And then we see with the Goswamis, then that would be cut back even more. They would sleep if they didn't forget to sleep. You know, they might sleep an hour and a half, 2 hours a day. Sometimes they would be talking all night about Krishna and forget to sleep. Right? They're having a good time. When we have a good time, we forget about sleeping. We forget about eating. So like that, they were always having a good time, so they always forgot. Raghunath Das, you know, every other day would take a palm full of buttermilk. You know, some Charinamrita, and that's it. So it just naturally evolves like that. You know, defending starts to go, mating starts to go, sleeping starts to get cut back. When that's cut back, then the eating goes. Right? Defending means there's a lot of desire, and that affects the nerves. You know, there's more passion. So then there's more interest in mating. When that is reduced, then also those two are reduced, sleeping naturally can go down. And then that affects eating. You want to sleep less, you have to eat less. So they're all interconnected. You eat things that are too rajasic, it creates more interest in material desire, material anxiety. So like this, the interconnection is there. So the whole idea is Krishna is giving ways how all these aspects can be used in his service. Right? Very, very nicely. He gets right into detail. If you want to eat, this is the process. You want to sleep, this is the process. You want to mate, this is a process. You want to defend, this is a process. The scriptures describe all this in detail. Right? And then one is able to follow those details for Krishna. Very, very, basically very simple. So now, it's also very important to understand what is the definition of Vedic culture. That Vedic culture, then, many times you hear devotees say, well, Prabhupada describes something, you know, but that's not Vedic culture. We don't follow Vedic culture. We have to understand is that what Prabhupada is talking about is coming from the broad body of Vedic culture. But the Vedic culture is made so that those in all different levels, they can engage themselves according to God's direction, according to Krishna's direction. So then that is from those who are very deeply absorbed in the mode of ignorance, up to those who are very qualified in the mode of goodness, and those endeavoring for pure goodness. So now, that's the whole breadth of the Vedic culture. Now, within that, what is the means, it's pointed out that the essence of the scriptures is always remember Krishna, never forget him. And Lord Chaitanya makes the point that in the scriptures, they only describe three things: our relationship with the Lord, the process to worship the Lord and attain the Lord, and the goal of pure love for Krishna. That's all the Vedic literatures are describing. Nothing else. So if we understand these two points, that means that if you take from the Vedic literature, from the Vedic culture, those aspects that are meant for devotees who are trying to attain pure love for Krishna, that is actually the essence, and that is the real Vedic culture, because that's what the Vedic culture is meant for. Right? These lower aspects are there, so the principles are in place. Right? You have someone, they are worshipping Kali. So, they're worshipping. Now they'll approach their guru, they'll respect their guru, they'll receive mantra, they'll learn a process of worship, they will respect their deity, they'll have a goal that they want, some material desire, right? They understand their relationship with the deity. So all the aspects of Sambandhavideya Prayojana are present. Right? So now, everything, the Vedic culture is in place. So the details of it may be fit for someone in the mode of ignorance. Now, but at least they accept the principle. The Kali worshipper accepts approaching the guru, respecting the guru. Accepts that there is a proper lifestyle if I actually want to worship Kali properly and attain my goal. There's a proper body of system of worship and ritual that I have to follow, that I will gain that goal. And then I have my goal. And that there is a goal to something, not that I'm just doing it for no reason. So it's all planned. So now all you have to do is change that. So and take out Kali and put in Krishna. Right? Then, instead of just approaching someone, some materialistic person who knows the Tantra, now we approach someone who knows Krishna, a devotee, right? Then we respect them. We learn from them the lifestyle best for worshipping Krishna. We learn from them the rituals, how to serve Krishna. And we understand the goal is pure love. So all we've done is changed the detail. the principles have been left 100% intact. Therefore, Prabhupada recommends that even someone following the Vedic culture, even if it's on this platform of just worshipping the demigods, is still better situated than if we don't follow the culture, because all the points may not be in place. Right? So we see that the importance of this, right? And then what is the difficulty that if we don't grow up in that, or we don't accept that, right? One, we don't necessarily understand or approach advanced personalities. We don't know how to deal with them. We don't know how to properly respect them. We don't really see the importance of a process or a body of rules and regulations to control our life. We don't keep the goal prominent. Sounds familiar? Yeah. So now, this is the point. Is that this whole thing is there just to make it easy for us to advance. So the principles are always in place. So now it's just, we put Krishna there, the principles remain in place, and we only take those details that are of the Vedic culture in connection to Krishna. And if you leave everything else, then we can't say, well, now it's not Vedic culture. Vedic culture is only meant to worship Krishna. There's no other purpose. So what Prabhupada gives us and calls the Vedic culture, because he uses the words many times, right? Vedic, Vedas, Vedic culture. I mean, if one wants to know, go into the folio, type it in, push the button, and you won't see one or two references. You're going to see hundreds. Prabhupada always talked about the Vedic culture. So what he's giving us, that is the Vedic culture. What Prabhupada talks about, that is the real Vedic culture. So we shouldn't try to twist it. Well, no, it's not, and it's Prabhupada's, and it's not Vedic, and so therefore anything Vedic. This is an uninformed opinion. And it's just, and it's that only, it's an opinion. Because in the Vedas, it describes all these things that Prabhupada is talking about. And the Vedas themselves will say what Prabhupada is talking about is the essence. The most essential points Prabhupada gives are there in the Veda. And they say that. Therefore, the Acharyas, the Goswamis, they've gone through the literatures, and they have come up with this body of rules and regulations for us. You know? So then, yeah. So that is what we have. So then the Grihastha, the Brahmachari is practicing his platform of it. The Grihastha then practices their platform of that. And then this brings us to Vanaprastha, where one then is getting more detached from this. One again starts to deepen one's study. One starts to contemplate what they're studying against what they have learned now. They can look back and see so many years of life, you know, what they learned as students, what they've learned as Grihasthas, you know, the practical understanding. In other words, they solidify that realization, right? And then, after that, they start teaching that to others, benefiting others with that. Right? Because then others can gain from this. As we see, the process hearing, practicing, contemplating, then realizing, then teaching. That's the complete process. So here, the Vanaprastha deepens their realization, and then they teach what they know. Because they've seen a lot. Right? One is generally not attaining Vanaprastha at a young age, at 5 years old or something. That's generally coming later in life. Then one is able to benefit others. One is able to train the others. Like that. Right? And sannyas is meant for just dedicating to that teaching. So this is basically what we described before, going through of the ashrams. So now if there were any questions, because we didn't finish the questions from last class, then, yes. Sannyas versus Khetra sannyas. Okay. Khetra sannyas technically can be taken by any of the ashrams. Khetra sannyas is simply a vow to remain and serve in the Dhamma. That's specifically what it is. Someone can be a sannyas and be a kshetra sannyas. Well, someone could also be a vanaprastha or a grihastha or a brahmachari. It's just making the vow to reside in the Dham. That's the essential point. Yes. Yeah. Means that one always stays in the Dham and always performs, how you say, the devotional activities. Because then everybody can take. Because the idea is the devotees, the Vaishnavas, they are Brahmins, so Brahmins take sannyas. Right? But at the same time, it's a conditioned nature is there. Right? So though they have the, how you say, the understanding and the culture and the goal of a Brahmin, they still have the conditioned nature. Right? So that means Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. So accordingly, they will find themselves happily situated in sannyas. So therefore, kshetra sannyas gives the opportunity for everyone to take sannyas. Right? Though it may not carry the form of what we call as tridandi sannyas. You know, where we, how you say, tridandi meaning the pre-vrajakacharya. Like that. We will take other aspects. Like that. You know, we have the others, Bahudak, where they live outside the family but still are maintained by the family. Kutichak, where they beg in the village and not maintained by the family. Parivrajakacharya then travels. And then the Paramahamsa then again sits down in one place. So the kshetra means they're sitting down and they're increasing their devotional activities. You know, like that. So that aspect. Because if you're in the Dham, you don't need much. You don't endeavor for much. You don't take kshetra sannyas and you're doing a flourishing business, bringing in millions of dollars, you know, and building a big house. Kshetra sannyas is you do what you need to maintain yourself at whatever level is comfortable for you at that time. Right? And as you reside in the Dham and perform one's bhajan, naturally that simplifies. So that will naturally gradually develop into, you know, the form of detachment that you would expect from Parivrajakacharya, though you may not travel. Does that make sense? So that way everybody can do that. So then that way all the Brahmins can take vanaprastha sannyas. But that's based on meaning we increase the emphasis on the Vaishnav nature and reduce the dependence on our conditioned nature or attachment to our conditioned nature. So kshetra sannyas gives that opportunity. While the Parivrajakacharya means that there should be the natural conditional detachment that you would generally find with the Brahminical conditioned nature. Right? Does that make some sense? Yeah. Always in answering our understandings of the Vedic culture and all these things, we're always having to balance two things at once. You know? That's what makes it difficult. Is that there's always the transcendental platform, the Bhagavad platform, and then that has to be that than the conditioned nature, which is dealt with by the Pancharatrik and the Vedic, that has to be balanced with it. So you have to be able to see two things at once. Like that. Sometimes it seems unclear. It's very clear, but it's just you have to be able to see the two and overlay them on each other. Right? Everyone can understand the Bhagavad, everyone understands the other, but when you put them on top of each other, then sometimes the difficulty is there. So we'll always have that. One second. Oh, yes, you. Oh, you were first. Staying in the Dham is that same as Mathura Vas? Yes. The Dham means Mathura Vas. Because one is always in Vrindavan. And one is Mayapur, that is Gupta Vrindavan. Then in Puri, then there's that feeling, that separation from Vrindavan. Right? Lord Chaitanya, yeah. And then in Vrindavan, then one is in Vrindavan. Like that.
I've heard that wherever the chanting is going on and the devotional service is going on, ascension of devotees is there. And this service is Mathura, so you need not actually go to Mathura and that is like
yes, one can do like that. Means the point is wherever the chanting is going on in service, that is Vrindavan. That is true, but there is also the special significance of Vrindavan. Like that. Means that is true. If we have a temple, a community, nicely the devotional activities are going on, then that is Vrindavan. But when the condition, when the devotional activities are not going on nicely, it's not Vrindavan. Right? Well, Vrindavan is Vrindavan whether we're Krishna conscious or not. Generally, Kshetra Sannyas means going to the dhams that we find in India. Like that. Like that. Okay. You had a question?
Could you explain the ashram life in terms of varna?
Ashram life in terms of varna. Okay, one second. Your question is on this Kshetra Sannyas? In the back, what's your question? What is Babaji? Babaji means that one absorbs oneself in one's own bhajan and basically doesn't necessarily worry about others' development. Well, Gaudiya Nandi means that he practices his own bhajan, but he helps others. Jiva Goswami's definition of Gaudiya Nandi is when a group of bhajan anandis get together and discuss preaching and preach. You understand? So the whole point is it starts with everybody must be performing their own devotional activities, their own bhajan. They are chanting, they are studying, they're associating with devotees, you know, hearing Bhagavatam like this. Then they also go and benefit others. So that's a Gaudiya Nandi. Bhajan Anandi doesn't take that step of benefiting others. Well, Gaudiya Nandi is a Bhajan Anandi who benefits other people. Is Babaji a kind of sannyas? It is if it is practiced properly. It is Paramahamsa sannyas. Means one gives up the designations of the varnas and ashrams. Parivrajakacharya means we've accepted the designation of sannyas and where the symbols of sannyas. But the Babaji means that is given up. So it cannot be unnaturally taken. Just like we see Gaurakishordas Babaji Maharaj, he showed the Babajis of Navadvip that they were not Babajis. Right? He would sit down and just chant. Others would come along to sit with him, but they never could chant and last. They'd always get into something else. Setting up a little temple to make money or trying to do something, set up their own place. But he would just chant anywhere. He has a place, he has a hut, he sits there. No hut, he'll sit under a boat. You know? Then somebody offered him a place, a nice room that had an attached bath. And he says, good, you take that toilet, and I will do my bhajan in that toilet. You know, if you can put a lock on the inside of the door. That was his only request. You know? No one else could do that. So he showed they were not Babaji's. So Babaji is not cheap. You have, I think, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur one time went to Radhakund. He went there in his, you know, 1930s Jaguar convertible, you know, and one of the devotees was in a three-piece suit, was, I think, in spats and was driving. You know, the chauffeur, he came in that, his turban and that long coat and his patent leather shoes. They drove into Radhakund, he got out, he sat down on the bank of Radhakund and then gave a very powerful lecture on the 12 Upanishads. And then in that he mentioned that before there were 8, you know, devotees sitting at Radhakund and performing bhajan. He says, now there are more, maybe 108. But he was pointing out as those 108, none of them were of the standard of those 8 original. Means the 6 Goswamis and Lokanath and others, Bhugarbha and all these others. They dress as Babaji's, but it doesn't take much. You just go to Navadvip, you go to the cloth market. When you go to the cloth market, you ask for marking cloth. Marking cloth is the cheapest machine-made cloth. Very cheap cloth. So that is the bona fide, certified Babaji cloth by the Navadvip and the Vrindavan Babajis. Right? Babajis are above the rules, right? So they have to have their rule on what is the bona fide cloth. Then you should, depending upon your height, get the 40-inch width or the 36-inch width. And then you rip it to a length that you like. If you like a little bit more fancy, you can put a little bit extra on the side or in the front. And then you make a chudder of that, you know. And then, you know, you get some tilak stamps and you spend 45 minutes putting on your tilak. Spend 45 minutes following all the rules of the Hari Bhakti Vilas, washing your hands after going to the toilet. And this way you pass your day, right? Free from all rules and regulations. And this is Babaji. So if we see this, we understand that conditioned souls try to act as Babajis, but they're not Babajis. Because they're still bound by the need for religious principles. No conditioned soul should fool himself thinking, I do not need religious principles. We'll make up our own. Right? You see, devotees, we're not interested in the Vedic culture. You can practically, not always, but practically, the general devotee grihastha house, you go in, they all have their wall-to-wall rugs, they all have their pot, you know, their pot in the corner with a few dried, you know, leaves coming out of it. They all have their same pictures of Krishna and that on the walls. You know, they have a few little odds and ends. They have their cane furniture. It's the same. You know, the same Rajasthani, you know, curtains and you know, like that. It's the same. So they're saying, we don't need this culture. But they've developed their own culture. You have to have a culture. Conditioned soul must have culture. So you either follow Krishna's, follow a non-Vedic, or make up your own. Unless you're into, you know, some of the, you know, European greats, you know, you're into Jung or Nietzsche or like this. And you can take one of their cultures. but like this, you must have. So the Babaji's, they think, I am a Babaji, I am Paramahamsa, free from the rules. And they'll always criticize ISKCON, oh, you're so much into the rules, so much opulence. But they have more rules than you can shake a stick at. They have so many rules. So many rules. They'll always be telling you, you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. Right? So actually, Paramahamsa, they don't care. They follow basic stuff. Gaurakishordas, Babaji Maharaj said, very easy to become a Babaji. Go down to the Ganges. They burn the bodies there. There's always a cloth they carry over the body when they go there, and that's taken off. And generally it gets left on the side. Maybe it gets burnt a little. No big deal. You rinse it out in the Ganges, put it on. You know, like that. There's plenty of boats sitting around. You know, they're always taking the boats out and putting them upside down to fix them. Sit under one of those. You know, and then you chant 3 lakhs. What's the problem? You know, and if Krishna sends something to eat, you eat. If he doesn't worry, right? Gaurakishora would be chanting till he finishes rounds, he won't eat. When his stomach would be growling too much, he'd pick up some mud from the side of the Ganga, eat that, and then tell his stomach to shut up. You know, like that. So then, you know, and then from eating, according to Ayurveda, if you eat dirt like that, raw dirt, then slowly, slowly, if you regularly do it, you'll go blind. So he went blind. He didn't care. So that is Babaji. Not this other stuff. Those aren't Babaji's. They may look like Babaji's. They're not Babaji's. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur pointed that out, and that was in the 30s, let alone today. So that's Babaji's. And then this question on the ashrams and the varnas. We mentioned a little bit of it, that generally one sees that it means the, how do you say, because of the understanding of a devotee by definition is automatically a Brahmin. That's why Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur then gave Brahmin threads to his devotees, so that people would, by minimum, accept them as Brahmins. Right? Vaishnava is higher than a Brahmin, but minimum they would accept as a Brahmin, not less than that. So otherwise, that's an offense. Because if you consider a devotee to be a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, that's an offense. So at least if they considered Brahmins are dear to Krishna. So therefore, that's minimum. Okay, they respect them as Brahmins, give that respect. Okay. Better they understand their devotees. So from this, then, everybody has the right to go through these 4 ashrams. But according to their conditioned nature, they may find that more or less comfortable. Right? Oh, another aspect. We discussed that before also. Is Krishna in the Gita then describes Nishkam Karma Yoga. Means that when he describes sannyas means giving up the activity that produces fruit. Therefore, for the materialistic sannyasis, they give up any activity that makes material result. They don't deal with fire, because fire then is yajna, gives result. They don't deal with fire, they don't cook, because that gives a result. They don't do business, they don't manage, they don't do anything, because all of that gives a result, because it's prescribed duties. Right? So he gives that up. So that's called sannyas. Tyag means is that you do the activity for the purpose of getting the result, then give up the result. Right? Understand the difference? One is you perform the activity, gets the result, you give it up. The other is you give up that activity. Then there's no result. So one is performed by the karmi, one by the jnani. So then Arjuna asks, you know, which is better? You know, do we follow you know, charity, what is it, penance, charity, penance, and sacrifice, or do we give them up? And Krishna says, in his opinion, they're not to be given up. They must be performed, because they purify even advanced persons. Even the great personalities are purified by them. But he brings it together, this same dual thing, you know, of that you perform the prescribed duty, but in the mood of the sannyasi. Right? The sannyasi, because he doesn't want the fruit, won't do the work. Right? Like, I'm fasting on Ekadasi, there's no way I'm going to go serve prasad, right? Because I'm fasting, isn't it? And then someone else, they're eating on Ekadasi, they'll eat. They'll deal with the prasad. And someone who's fasting, I won't deal with the prasad. So that's the natural way we look at it. Okay, those who are fasting on Ekadasi, they don't have to cut vegetables, they don't have to wash pots, they don't have to serve prasad, they don't have to cook, nothing, right? It's natural, it's fair, right? And then those who are, then they should be doing it. They should be cooking and eating and serving and washing pots and cutting vegetables. Right? So that's the two alternatives that Arjuna sees. Is you either give it up or you follow it because you want the result. You don't want the result, you give it up, the activity. And, or I want the result, I do the activity. But what's Krishna's answer? It's neither of those, because they're both still not that advanced. Right? So, what is he saying? He's saying is that you perform the activity without the desire for the result. Just like someone who's fasting, then they can serve prasad. Everybody else is eating, so let them sit down. The person who's fasting, let them serve. He doesn't want to eat. He's fasting. But he doesn't mind serving the devotees. So he sees it as a service. Others are dealing with it only because I'm going to eat. Or I'm not dealing with it because I'm not going to eat. In other words, the fruit is the cause of their endeavor. Right? Their own personal fruit. But what Krishna's saying is that we go for what's Krishna's interest. Right? Krishna's interest. So Krishna's interest, we serve devotees. So therefore, not because I'm eating or not eating, I'm serving the devotees. Right? So I'm performing the activities in connection with eating, but I'm not eating. So that's Nishkam Karma Yoga. You perform the activity, but you don't want the fruit. The activity will bear fruit, but we don't want it, and that fruit belongs to Krishna. Right? Tyag means, after getting the fruit, endeavoring for the fruit, I want the fruit, I give it away. Right? But here, Krishna's proper definition of sannyas is, I perform the activity that gets the fruit, but before I even start the activity, I've already given the fruit. The fruit's Krishna's. So I'm doing the activity just to please Krishna. You understand? So that is sannyas. So now whether you perform the prescribed duties of a brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, or kshatriya, vaishya, shudra, or brahmana, it doesn't matter. If one does it in that attitude of detached performance of prescribed duties for the pleasure of Krishna, that is sannyas. Right? So that's another very important understanding. Right? Then one can look at the conditioned nature where one is comfortable. Someone may have difficulty leaving the home environment. Right? Someone can take vanaprast but not take sannyas. Or they're vanaprast, they're living separate from the wife, or vanaprast living with the wife. Some may just remain as grihastha. You know, very much absorbed in what's going on. Like you see businessmen, many times, some of them can give up. Like in the Nectar Devotion, Prabhupada gives the example of one Lala Babu. Very big, wealthy, famous man in Calcutta. And businessman, but he gave it up, went to Vrindavan and became a devotee. But otherwise, many times you see is the businessman is there. You go into the shop, right? And, you know, the son is there, you know, seeing that everything's going nice. And you look over in the corner somewhere, and there's the old man. He's there, got his hand in his bead bag, or he's looking at his Gita, like that. So he's got one eye on the Gita and one eye on the cash box. You know? And the son's running the shop. But afterwards, then, you know, something happens and the customer didn't buy. Grandfather will call the son over and say, you should have said this, or you should have shown that sorry, or you shouldn't have let him in the first place. Or so even though he's detached, he's still attached. And it may be comfortable for them. You know? So like this, or many grow up, they never leave the house. They grow up in the house. They never go out and study under the teacher. They never become brahmacharis. So they're always grihastha. So whatever is comfortable, it doesn't matter. The point is that one should remember Krishna. But if one performs in this attitude of nishkam karma yoga, that's already sannyas. Right? Prabhupada many times, there's a he always talks like this, goes back and forth. It's the attitude that makes it. Sannyasa is not the external appearance. Just like a grihastha is not, just because someone puts on white and is married and has kids, doesn't mean they're actually a grihastha. They may be a grihamedi. Right? Grihastha means serving Krishna, going back to Godhead is the central pivot, and everything is dependent upon that. And it's never compromised. Well, if we'll compromise that, you know, okay, later. My ultimate goal is to go back to Godhead, but I'll compromise. That's a grihamedi. It may be a very, you know, a devotional grihamedi, but it still is, the house is the central pivot, not Krishna. Right? It means our own interest. Oh, they're a relationship to Krishna. So grihastha is also a very elevated position. You know, we like to focus our attention on just on the brahmacharis and sannyasis. But grihastha also is a very elevated position. Right? Like that. So one has to see. Another aspect is if one wants to take vanaprastha sannyas, then one must go through some training. There must be some training, control of the senses. The ideal thing is someone goes through the brahmachari ashram, then they learn to live simply, austerely, you know, serve others, not a problem for them. Then when the grihastha life is winding up, they can fall back on that. They have no fear about it. They did it. And you'll find with time, one always forgets unpleasant, right? Like you have a situation that was very unpleasant. You bring it up 10 years later, 20 years later, generally you'll laugh at it, you know? You forget the unpleasantness. You remember the nice parts, or, yeah, it was a bit wild, and, you know, we were a bit rough in those days, and that's all. So with time, you forget the rough, because the living entity is Ananda, Satchidananda. So only the Ananda will remember. We'll forget everything else. Right? Like we come from the last life to this life. We forget all the pains of the previous lives. And we're very happy this life to take up another, you know, life of enjoyment. So we only remember the happiness. We don't remember the difficulties. So then, after so many years, one can remember back, and yeah, it was nice. Brahmachari, you know, was free, we could do these things, this, that. It was not a problem. So one can fall back on that because of that previous practice. If it's not there, then it's like you're launching out into the unknown. One grew up in the house the whole time, you know, and this and that, and, you know, when he hits teens, he's just running around with the boys and the girls. And this, and you know, they got all their this and that, and do all their things. Then when they get older and that, then when it is time for kind of pulling out of that, what can they fall back on? What is their experience? Right? What do they have? Right? Therefore you see, even our own devotees, they're hitting mid-40s, they're hitting their 50s. Very few are pulling out. In fact, things aren't going right because they naturally just take that. All the glamour is gone, everything. And then because they can't pull out, then they think, well, it's because this marriage isn't going properly. And then they go for another one. Because there's no experience to fall back on. So, therefore, unless one practices, means, in other words, the grihastha brahmachari, then can move into vanaprastha, can move like this. So one must see these things. Then it becomes very easy. So, point is the soul means these are the ideal. The Vedic system is well thought out, very systematic, you know, proven. It works. So now if we find ourselves not in that ideal situation, then we do the best we can for the position we're at. We cultivate those knowledge, we cultivate these practices, and we get how much we can. Because the point is, ultimately, it's remembering Krishna, not forgetting. So whatever situation we find ourselves in, if we can remember Krishna in that situation, that's perfect. Right? Like life is easier. If you're 7 years old and you don't have to worry about balancing your, you know, income tax and all the business and all these different things, it's easier. But if that's the situation one finds oneself in, still one should remember Krishna. It's not the best situation, but whatever the situation, we should use it in Krishna's service. So therefore, the brahminical mentality is very easy to go through all four, in the externals. The Kshatriya nature generally easily goes through three. The Vaishya nature through the first two. Shudra nature is very comfortable with the second. That's the conditioned nature. But because they're devotees, that doesn't necessarily apply. Right? Because we're devotees, everybody has that inherent consciousness and understanding of a Brahman. So the subtle affects the gross. Right? From what you think, that's what you do. Right? Thinking, then you feel, then you will. You do it. Means thinking is in the mind. Feeling is then in the mind. Willing means the mind engages the senses and the body moves. Right? Like I think, maybe I should go to lunch. Then you think, yeah, I'm hungry. I didn't take breakfast this morning. And then you get up and go. Right? So it starts from the subtle. So if the consciousness is that of a Brahman, then that will affect even the conditioned nature. And that will bring out the best in it. So then one can progress nicely, however one can. It's not important. But in other words, these stages of attaining the consciousness of sannyas, attaining the consciousness of a Brahman, this is what we're endeavoring for. Because even if one is a sannyas, if he is still attached, what's the benefit? Right? Vishwamitra was sannyas with so much problem because of his material attachments, he just wanted to be the best, that's all. The best, most powerful, the top of the pile. Right? I don't remember the whole history, but basically he was a king at one point. And I think he understood there was the emperor, came to that platform, then he came across, I think it was Vishishta. Vishishta had a Surabhi cow. Then he came to him and he came with his whole army. And Vishishta said, no, you stay here with us. And he was thinking of poor Brahman, how he'll take care of us. He says, no, no problem. So from the Surabhi cow, then he generated all facilities for them and food and everything like that. So he was impressed. So then he thought, the king should have the best. This cow is definitely, can be very useful. He can take care of all kinds of other kings and this and that. So then he thought, I should have the cow, right? Because his whole motive in life was to be the best and have the best. So then Vishishta said, well, I don't mind. It's like, you know, it's necessary for my yajna because I take all the ingredients that I need in the sacrifice from the cow. You know, I need ghee, I need other things like this, and I get it. Otherwise, I have to go out and so much endeavor to go and pick them from the forest. It's that she gives everything. But it's kind of like the emperor wants, and what can I do? So then, Sarabi comes to Vashishta and says, you know, you're giving me? You know, he says, I'm not gay. He's asking. And then she said, so you want me to go? And he says, no, I'm very happy with your service and all this. And she said, so that means you're not going to endeavor to say no. And he says, no, I can't. Brahman, and this is very, you know, aggressive, you know, very aggressive Kshatriya and, you know, lower modes. So they just, this is what they want. Let them have it, you know. Why I should fight it and make trouble. So she said, okay, so you're not going to say no, but do you mind if I don't go out of my own desire? And then he said, that's up to you if you like. So then immediately she took this huge size, and that out of all her different flanks and her tail and this and that came all these Aukshahinis of armies, the, you know, Yavana armies and Mlecha armies and other kinds of, all kinds of crazy armies. And then they chased Vishwamitra and all his armies for 80 miles, right? And then killed his whole army and just left him alone, right? Then he's sitting down and he's thinking, you know, I, you know, made my way up through this whole pile, this whole administrative management power, you know, hierarchy. And I became to the platform of emperor. And now I find that this Brahmin with his cow is more powerful than me. So he decided I'm going to be a Brahmin. Right? So they gave up his kingdom, sat down to do austerities, this, that. And this is then, you know, Menaka comes and all these things. He has all these problems, right? So then, you know, eventually he makes it. Then he does great austerities and Lord Brahma comes. And he asks, what do you want? He says, I want to be a Brahma Rishi. Right? So a Brahma Rishi means those great personalities that are born directly from Lord Brahma. You know, like Vashishta and Bhrigu and Narad, the four Kumaras, Angira, like this. They're directly from Brahma. They're called Brahma Rishis. No one else can be Brahma Rishis, just by definition. But he's demanding, I must be a Brahma Rishi. So then Brahma says, okay, you'll be counted as a Brahma Rishi. And then he says, no. So he says, are you satisfied? Brahma asks him. He says, no. He says, why not? I said you'll be a Brahma Rishi. He says, when Vashishta says I'm a Brahma Rishi, then I'll be satisfied. So they had to call Vashishta, because Vashishta is the one who started the problem. So Vashishta then had to say, yes, you're a Brahma Rishi. Then he was very satisfied. But you see, still he would have so much problems. Because, you know, when one unqualified person came, wanted to go to the heavenly planets, said, I can't perform all these sacrifices, this, that. So he says, okay, I'll send you. So he sends, and then Indra sends him back down, and then he sends him back up. And then the guy's stuck in the space, and he says, you know, get me out of here, you know, I'm happy on the ground. He says, no, I'll create your own heavenly planet. So he made this big planet, put him on there, but he didn't have enough potency to keep it in orbit. So then Vishnu had to come in and take care, like this, you know. I think also after Shakuntala, then he decided, this is a problem, you know, that this whole thing is that, okay, I understand that the, you know, material world must go on, the living entities must take birth, but, you know, you get involved with these ladies, a lot of problem. So now the main thing is then the, you know, you need women for children. So then he thought, okay, so we need the children. So then why bother with the women? We'll grow them on trees, right? So then he started growing them on coconut trees. Right? And then he was very happy, you know, got a nice tree full of, you know, what do you call it, you know, little kids, and then you get them, you can teach them all nicely in the Veda and everything. So then word got around, you know, And the demigods, no one knew what to do about this. You know, new insanity dreamt up by Vishvamitra. So then they went to Lord Vishnu, and Vishnu came to him and said, you know, it's a nice idea, I appreciate, but, you know, people have come to the material world for all this kind of stuff, so you kind of, you know, forget this idea. But he said, I'll give the benediction that this fruit will always be the best thing for sacrifice, will be very, very good for the humans, like that. You know, I think that's how the name calls in Sanskrit, Narikal. Nari is means woman. How exactly it works, I don't know, but the Sanskrit. And you see, it's got face, it's got eyes, mouth, and everything. Prabhupada mentioned, and yeah. So it's that's because it was before was, you know, that was where the babies were growing on the trees like that, coconut trees. I'm not sure how you harvested them, but whatever. Then. But that was, so this is Vishvamitra. So it's, you'll find that even though the desires, there's sometimes these things are there, so it's the difficulties are there. Does that make some?
That student which is coming from Vaishya community and Sutra community, for them there is different subject matter because they cannot understand, they cannot grasp the philosophy of Vedic.
In the Gurukul system, all four varnas would learn from the Gurukul. Means your Brahmins would learn all the philosophy, you know, theory, culture, and the practical application of their varna in the school, complete. The Kshatriyas would learn the philosophy, all the theology, the theory, and certain aspects of the practical. You know, how they dealt and their sacrifices and all these things, right? Because the Brahmin does six things. He worships, he teaches it to others, performs it for others, he studies, he teaches it to others, he accepts charity, gives charity. But the Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, the Kshatriyas, they can perform their own sacrifices, they can give in charity, and they can do their own study, right? Like this, but they can't do the other three. So those aspects are practical. But other than that, then outside the school, they go and they study in the kingdom, and they study under other managers, other administrators, and they learn from them. Right? Unless there's a specific school like Dronacharya ran, which is a Brahmin is teaching those things specifically just for Kshatriyas. But otherwise, then generally if they went to the regular Gurukul, then the Kshatriya would learn that, and at a point he would graduate, go back to the kingdom, and he would learn from the Rajguru, he would learn from the ministers, he'd learn from the generals. And this way then he would complete his study until he was ready, and then he would be crowned prince. You know, crowned the king, you know. Then the Vaishya, he'll learn the philosophy, he'll learn the, you know, the culture, he'll learn proper dealings with people. But business you won't learn in the Gurukul. That you learn from another businessman. You can't theoretically give anyone business. Business comes from, you know, life comes from life, so business comes from businessman, that's all. It's that simple. Like that. And there's no business school in the world who teaches businessmen to do business. Right? All the business schools in the world are for the people, are for the Shudras to learn business that the Vaishyas will hire. Interesting point, right? Means sometimes just for prestige, children of business families go to Harvard School of Business Management, this and that. But it's just to say that you went to Harvard. Otherwise, you don't learn how to do business. They may learn a few of the modern techniques of advertising, you know, some of these other things, you know, the way the different economies work. But the essential principle of business, how to be a businessman, that you can't teach in the school. Because that's gained from another businessman. Like that. The business school just teaches some of the technique. The technique doesn't make a businessman. To make the right decision at the right time is not technique. Does that make sense? Do you think it makes sense? Do you agree with that? No, him, back there. No, you. Yeah, you. The striped shirt, yeah. Because I've said this hundreds of times in front of businessmen, and they've all agreed. These actual businessmen, they all say, yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Because they won't. Because that's not the place you learn. The place you learn is, here's a sari, here's a person, this is what you do. You know? You throw out the sari. You see they're getting bewildered. You don't show them anymore. Right? You give them too many, they can't make up the decision. You throw it out. You see they take the border. That they like. But it's not quite gelling. So they like that style. They want a different color. You throw that out. So you have to know how to judge. You know, how to throw it. You ever see, they don't just take the sari and unfold it. There's a whole thing they take and it floats across. You know? Right? It's
so
an art.
Would that be taught?
Yeah, that's taught right on the floor. You go in the business, you'll learn it in a few months. You go to the school, it'll take you years. Why? Vaishyas are known by their pragmatic, minimalist nature. So why waste the time? Means they'll get down to business. By the time the guy's gotten out of business school, then he'll hire the guy. And he can sit behind the 20 phones and in the three-piece suit and look important. And they'll sit in the next room and chew pan. Right? You see that in Calcutta. Very funny. One devotee went to make life memory. Went to some, you know, had a name for big, big guy. Right? And he thought, okay, you know, finally, after so long, we've gotten the guy's name and address and contact and made the appointment. He comes into the office, big, huge office, you know, big desk, a guy behind it in a three-piece suit and all that, very official looking. There's, you know, is that 10, 20 phones there? They're all going at once and everything. And finally he gets to the pitch and makes the thing for the life member and asks him to become the member. And then the guy says, well, I have to ask the boss. And he thought, well, this guy was the boss. Then there's a little door on the side of this air-conditioned office, very fancy, you know, really decked out, you know. They've, you know, brought in all the modern, you know, interior decorators to do it up in really modern kind of style. Then there's a little door on the side. You open the door, and outside there's a little balcony. You know, it's just onto the streets of Calcutta. And out there there's a mattress. And on this mattress there's this big, fat Marwari guy in a dhoti and a t-shirt. With a little fan on the side, you know, no AC, and just chewing pan. Right? And then he goes out and asks the boss what he should do. So the guy in the chair, that's the guy from the Harvard School of Business Management. And the guy out on the veranda, that's the businessman. Right, so it's a totally different scene, like that. It's an interesting. Someone told me about a report from America. They did a big study on all the big corporate, you know, the heads of the biggest corporations, business corporations in America, and it was found that all the big guys, they all started off as, you know, like the peons, the guy who'd serve the tea, the janitors, and they worked their way up and they hit the top. And then they noticed that all the wallahs that came out of, you know, these big business schools, they came in, you know, middle management positions, and they stayed their whole life in middle management positions. They don't move up. Because they're not vaishyas. Or they're vaishyas without the ability to make money. You do have vaishyas like that. Like that. They're good for gophers and stuff like that. It means they can do short-term works, you know, get themselves fired up, do it, and then collapse, you know. Need a little vacation, this, then do the next thing, and do, you know. They can do responsible things short term. Like that. So if you find you have anybody in the temple like that, then that's a vaishya that can't make money. You know, if they can take it and just keep going through, then, you know, that's either a vaishya who can make money or someone else. So it's very subtle. What makes the Vaishya, what makes the Kshatriya, what makes the Brahmin, it's very subtle. It's not the external. It's just like you have musician. Now, musician, if you say musician, immediately everyone will say Shudra. But there are Brahmins who know music. That is their area of study. That's their area of knowledge. But they'll only sing for the deity. Like you had all the Goswamis and Vrindavan and all that. Then Akbar was trying like anything to get, you know, Hari Das and others to come down and sing. But their point is, we don't sing. We sing for the biggest king. We sing for Krishna. We don't sing for material kings. Right. So that's the Brahmin. He sings for the deity. He follows his art. He practices his culture. He won't compromise the Shastra for someone's taste. He will use the Shastra to present it so that it is nice. But the Shudra will sing for people. You pay, he'll sing. Like that. He will adjust to make himself attractive so that people will pay so he can sing. But the Brahmin will sing, you pay, you don't pay. It's you know, he's doing his singing. So it's a difference in the mentality. You know? Kings, landlords, you know, they're very similar. Landlords are vaishyas. So then the landlord protects the people in his area to get the tax. The kshatriya takes the tax to protect the people. Right? It's just, you have a body of knowledge. The vaishya sees, I can benefit by this. I endeavor, I get it. How far I get, once I have it, that's it. Hmm. Like Vaishya wants to learn puja, he learns it. Once he learns it, he's happy that he knows it, that's it. So unless he's really into puja, he won't do any more puja. Now and again, okay, there's a festival, but he won't do daily. Unless he's, you know, has very much that mood, then he may do his own puja daily. Like that. But otherwise, you see, they have a they see the profit. I will gain from this. The kshatriya is the challenge, I will learn this. And for the Brahmin, this is their sphere of activities. So all the three are taking the knowledge, but they're approaching it completely different. It's the mentality. You know? That's why if we just take the externals, you know? If they're writing on a blackboard E equals MC squared, they're a Brahmin. They're walking around with an AK-47 or an M-16, they're a Kshatriya, right? If they're sitting on a mountain of grain, then they're a Vaishya. And if they operate a jackhammer, then they're a Shudra. But if we take that only, it'd be very difficult to work out Varnashram because the subtleties are so fine, right? Because that person, you know, there holding the AK-47 is a Shudra, he's not a Kshatriya. You know, because he's being managed by the actual kshatriyas. The cannon fodder is not kshatriyas. So it's very, the whole system is very fine. So that's the thing, is that it just doesn't work teaching in that way. You can teach some of the techniques that's taught, but it's taught in the place. Just like, give an example. Let us teach farming in the classroom. How much farming can you teach in the classroom? Means never go out and touch the dirt and plant a seed or water it or weed it or anything. We'll do everything in the classroom. You know, and now we'll have virtual reality, right? We'll have a nice program and you can go there and plant the seeds and grow it all. But will he actually get a farmer? He doesn't know the earth. He doesn't know all these different things. You know, very subtle. So there's a limit how much you can teach. So business, a few things you can teach. But the actual working of it has to be in the workplace. Just like you can teach, you know, dairy farming, you know, also in a classroom. They've never seen a cow, touched a cow. But does that mean they actually know how to deal with a cow? They come out of the classroom. They've gotten, you know, 4-point average, you know, then you stick them out there, here's okay, here's a nice cow. And then, here's your bucket, okay, go for it. Then will it happen? Good chance it won't. So it's a practical thing. Business is very practical. So you have to learn it in the place. Few things you can teach. But you have to learn, because it's an art. So arts are practical. There's the austerity of going through them. You know? The administration, you have to practically do it. You know? And that requires a kingdom to do it, or a place of management, or a place of business, or a place of the art. Well, the Brahman, then in the Gurukul, the worship of the deity, the chanting of the mantras, the teaching, the studying, that is the place of work. Therefore, the Brahman can learn everything in the Gurukul. The Kshatriya can learn like 3/4, Vaishya or half, like that, the Vaishya less. Shudra simply learns the theory. You don't have to learn the art in the Gurukul. You learn the art from someone who knows the art, and you learn the Shastra behind the art from the Gurukul. Like that. So in the tradition, many times they would come at off hours and study that. But they would, let's say if they're learning music, they would learn music from the music guru, another musician. And then they would go to the Gurukul and learn the music theology, what the Shastra says, the Gandharva Veda. That's if they were of that caliber. Otherwise, they would just learn what their teacher knows, and that's it. Does that make some sense? Okay. We should probably end here. You have other classes you go to in that? No.
I want to bring up the question from yesterday, how to take care of the dependents.
That's right.
I thought you're developing like a big farm community. You may have to hire people that are to do the work, but they are not very interested in Krishna consciousness, how to take care of them.
Yeah, no, this is good. I'm just thinking this is an important topic. We should. You mind if we take it up tomorrow? But someone has to remind me that this is bad. You know? Because otherwise it's already... Okay. Deal a bit little with it. Tomorrow's the last day, no? Because the next day is the dependence. The main thing of dealing with dependence is a shelter. So this applies to all levels. This is why it becomes very difficult to separate. Protection means protecting children, protecting women, protecting Brahmins, cows, and old people. And then, those who are, then in this case, if one has workers, or the Shudras are considered like children. They're the children of the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, whoever they're working for. So if you have a farm community, then those who work in this, they'll be the dependents. So they're dealt with like that. So children means we deal with their needs, their desires. Right? We deal with their needs, their desires. So we must see that they're satisfied, but also within reason of your values of your community. Right? They need money. We see that they get their amount, they're taken care of, whatever, how much you can bring them in or how much out they are. But they're dealt with very nicely. So it's just like a small child is always dealt with nicely. So in the same way as those who are dependents are always dealt with nicely. So whatever is our position, if we're parents, the children are dealt with nicely. If we're managers, we deal with those under us nicely. You know, if we're farming and we have those assisting in it, we have to deal with them nicely. So this principle, the whole thing must be seen together. This is one of the difficulties of issues. Right? An issue means I isolate one problem, take it out of context, blow it up so it makes it into something substantial that I can, you know, absorb my whole life in, and then try to solve the problems of the universe by dealing with the issue. So the problem is like allopath medicine, it gives side effects, because that's what they do. They take the active ingredient out of its natural environment and then introduce that into the human body, and then now, because it's a poison now, it gives side effects. It may do some work, but it also gives side effects. So the Ayurvedic is that you leave the active ingredient in its natural environment, or whatever is the other ingredients in that herb or mineral that it's from, because those also are working on the body in other ways. You know, they're dealing with the subtle side so the active ingredient can work. Then you get a more complete cure. It's maybe a little slower, but it's complete. And there's no side effects. So when we take an aspect out like this, and we only deal, let's say, with parents, or we only deal with teachers, or we only deal with... No, you have to see it all. Dealing with mothers, fathers, you know, parents together, you know, any leader of the community or manager, teachers, you know, gurus, you know, and in the shloka, demigods, it's the same tattva. You cannot separate them. You can't crimp down on one and leave the other without any consideration. It doesn't make sense. So because of that, then you deal with one problem, and then you get rid of that, seemingly, you think, and then others come up, because everything's interdependent. Right? If the parents don't deal with the child properly, it's very difficult for the teachers to deal properly. It's very difficult for the community authorities to deal properly. It's very difficult for spiritual authorities to deal properly. It's all connected. Right? The spiritual leaders don't deal properly, it affects everybody else. The community leaders don't deal properly, then that affects the families. Right? The father can't function properly, therefore he can't take the mother, has difficulty functioning, therefore the kids have difficulty. It's all interconnected. It's one entity. That's the parental rasa. So parental rasa has its ways it works, and it has to work in that way. The person in the senior position has to care for the one below, but they must be respected by the one below. Both have to be there. You can't correct one without the other. So that is the reason that the Vedic system takes a complete look at everything. Then you can solve it. By the methods that the modern world uses of issues, nothing will ever be solved, nothing can be solved, nothing ever was solved. It was interesting. I always find it very amusing how many devotees are very interested that the children learn modern history, because they think it's very valuable. And they always quote that, you know, you learn from history. Then I was talking with a devotee the other day who was a history major, you know, 4-point average history major in Yale University. You know, good university. And the historians themselves in the university, the students, teachers, they say the only thing you learn from history is that nobody learns from history. Because I see is that since time immemorial, everyone just dealt with issues in the Western culture, and nothing's ever been solved. But we still want to use the same methodologies and think we're going to come out with flying colors. So one has to look at the whole thing complete. It all goes together. And so therefore, then one will say, okay, unless the whole thing is done, then it can't work. That's the next natural point. So where does that start? That both starts from the individuals, that everybody as an individual must accept and understand their position, And it starts with the leaders, them understanding so they can help guide others. So both these have to do. So therefore, everyone should try to understand themselves. Then when you find those who can understand, from them you look for leaders. Right? We were discussing this morning, is the you know, how you say? Modern method is you look for, okay, we need a manager, look for someone who can manage. And then that's generally it. They can manage, okay, let's try them out. If you wanted to add in Vedic elements, then you look, okay, someone who can manage. Then we look at who can actually understand, how you say, how to deal with people. Then we would look, okay, from those who could deal with people, then who would be able to themselves be able to lead. Then of that, who would be able to, who practice it themselves. But generally, those last ones in the modern concept, you don't throw in. But the Vedic would take it the other way around. First, find those who they themselves can personally follow. Then we'll talk. Then from amongst those, then we'll look for those who can relate and deal with others properly. Then from amongst those, we'll look those who can lead. Right? Then from amongst those who can lead, then we will look, can they administrate or can they advise? So it's a very different approach. So it starts with the individual, but you're looking for the leaders who then are going to establish and make the facilities and see that the training and everything goes on. But to start, you have, it's not from a raise of hands. Right? Because it's the same principle. Just like we say, you can't rubber stamp a guru. You can't rubber stamp a leader either, a parental president, anyone, a parent. Right? You can't rubber stamp them. Because it's the same rasa. What applies for one applies for the other. You know? Like that. So it goes across the board. One has to see the qualification. Then from there. Otherwise, nowadays, something comes up, there's a big hullabaloo, so much emotion is there, the issue is running strong, then they ask, okay, who wants to be involved in forming a committee to work it out? So many hands go up, you know, they make their come together, make some initial plans, everyone says what is their main, you know, feelings, write down some, you know, heavy resolutions, and then they work out when's the next meeting, and then that's where it falls apart. Right? Because they can never establish the next meeting. And even if they make the next meeting, there'll never be another one. Right? Because this isn't the way. Because that's not their thing. They just have a feeling, an opinion. But that doesn't mean that everybody has an opinion. Right? And everybody wants everything to go nicely. But you have to find those who can make it go nicely. They're the leaders. Like that. So when you establish your leaders, then you have the followers. And then the followers, according to their position, you take care. Vaishyas must be allowed to make a lot of money. You can't control that. Though there must be some kind of form of tax. And there should be training and social pressure that they should give in charity. But otherwise, how they run their business, this, that, you find as soon as the administration gets involved in business, it doesn't work. How many temple businesses work from the administrative platform? If they are working, it's only because somebody knows business. And generally you find the best businesses are running outside. Right? So the Kshatriyas never try to run the business, because that's not their thing. Business is not their administration is their thing. Businessmen, that's their businessmen do business. But they must give tax, they must give in charity. And then how they want to live, that's up to them. You know? I mean, opulently. They can't disturb the community. The administrators must see that they're following. Like that. Administrators must be given that their freedom to manage by those who are giving advice. The Brahmin, no, I have spoken. But then that's where it stops. He can't then demand that the administrator follows him. No, then he should do it himself. Brahman means he advises. And if no one wants to listen to him, he also is not obligated to stick around. But he makes the advice, and when it and the kshatriya takes it, when it works, then the glorification goes to the kshatriya. If everybody in the community goes, our community is so nice because we have such great managers, the Brahmins let them all say that. They never actually go, well, actually, it was my idea. No, but the kshatriya knows that it's the Brahmin gave him that idea. So therefore, the kshatriya always respects the Brahmin. Very subtle. Everyone must know where their limit is. The Vaishya, he has his difficulties. He wants facilities. He knows what it should be like, but he has to leave it up to the managers to get it done. Because otherwise his tendency is to get it done so it works nicely for their work. Right? Like you have a temple where you have a devotee with a Vaishya nature. Sankirtan's going great. Temple looks great. Temple's dead. There's no training going on in the temple. You know, there's only a few brahmacharis, brahmacharinis bringing in big money. And they're burning out every couple of years. And then it's just, well, they're insincere. But temple looks fabulous. Like that. They have nice things, good presentations. No life. Right? Because that everything is profit and loss. This devotee doesn't do sankirtan, there's loss. This devotee moves out of the temple, there's loss. So therefore, you can't do these other things. Kshatriya is like, everybody has a nature that must be engaged. Those who are good at business and collecting, they'll do that, and they should be pressured to do that, because that is the nature. And if they're being lazy, then they should be pressurized. Those who don't have should do something else. So they see the broad picture, so therefore they can engage so many people. Right? And then you see a nice, vibrant, more vibrant temple. But as long as they also respect those with the brahminical qualities, then they'll be training. So a good kshatriya understands that. And then the Brahmins, if they're running a temple, you'll find it's very vibrant and all that, though it may not be very wealthy. Maybe it will. Depends upon if they know the art of management, know the art of dealing with economics. Then, if that's their thing, then it may be very good. Otherwise, it's nice, simple, everybody's happy, the worship's going nice, prasad's nice, but it's all simple. You know? Like that. So everybody should know where their limit is, because otherwise then you don't get a good result in the community. Right? Like that. It means those who know management get upset when everybody's telling them what to do, and they know that they don't know what they're talking about. They see a problem, but let them work out the problem. Businessmen are freaking out if everybody's telling them what to do and give all their money and this and that, and they're in Maya and all that. They can't work because they know how to do business. So everybody else should leave them alone. Right? So like this. It means everyone must know their nature and understand where the line is. Right? Good fences make good neighbors. So when that's understood, then you can work nicely. Okay? A good manager, if he wants to bring in money, he'll talk to people who know how to make money. Right? It's like that. He wants to set up training programs. He knows that they should be there because he has been trained, but he will call those who know how to train people and get their opinion. He wants to develop arts, he'll call an artist. You know, if he wants to do interior decorating, unless that's one of his hobbies, then he'll call someone who knows how to do it. Why he'll do on his own? Right? So it's very important that everybody knows their position. Then you actually get leaders and you get followers. So then accordingly, when you're dealing then with hired people and this and that, if they're interested in Krishna consciousness, then you bring them in as much as possible, engage them as much as possible, but they want their result. They're worried the most about their they're the most anxiety about their facility. So they really want their money, like that. Vaishyas are not so much, because they know I can make it. Okay, if I lose something here and there and this and that. Like we had somebody here, ran the shop here for years, built it up. Somebody gave 50,000 rupees. In a few years, he had 10 lakhs of stock. That's stock. It means he, from investments, had gone from 50,000 to 10 lakhs. It means 20 times the amount in a few years. His own endeavor. That's a businessman. Then profits, then that's another thing. How much above, how much they were giving to the temple, this set. He decided, okay, you know, this scene, wants to take the family, they go to America. He gave that whole shop to the temple. He's not in anxiety, well, you know, this and that. He gave it. He knows, I'll start another business. They know business, they start another business, they'll make money. So that slight amount of detachment is there. It means the principle of attachment is there, but they can, okay, I'll give up this one, take that one. So you have these, yeah. So then, So the leaders must be able to understand how to take care, right? The shudras must be taken care of very nicely, because that's what they need. They're like kids, you have to take care of them more. It's harder for them to take care of themselves. Adults can take care of themselves, but kids can't. So shudras are dealt with like that. Because they need to be taken care of. Like that. You know, that's that whole group, they must be taken care of. The children, the Brahmins, the women, the old people, and the cows, they must be taken care of. So you have to approach it as a complete package. Like nowadays, protect the students must mean you must wipe out the teachers. Or to protect the women, you must wipe out the men. You know? Or to protect the cows means you have to shut down all other projects. You know? Or to set up, you know, training of shudras and varnashram, you must shut down the Mayapur project. But this is all projections where people don't understand the whole system. Because it all goes together. It's all connected. You pull on one string, it affects everything else. You have a piece of cloth, you pull on one, everything else moves. Maharaj is not happy. This man yesterday went into Calcutta to pick him up. Then Maharaj comes out of the airport, he's not there, gets in his own taxi, drives out here. Once he gets here, a phone call comes from Calcutta wanting to know where he is. Then he finds, you know, and the guy who went to get him is in Calcutta. So this is the second year in a row it's happened. So the Maharaj is not happy. Okay. So, Haisa, one must have that mood of protection. Then it can go. Because because you see is that all these also, the child then grows up. Women, when they're protected, they give protection to the children. Right? So if they don't feel protection, then they can't concentrate on the children. Then they have to take care of themselves. Right? Just like the Brahmin. He'll concentrate on the students, train, teach, study. He can only do that if other people are giving in charity. If he's got to go out and do business, how will study and teach? You know, how the mother will take care of the children if she's got to go out and hold down a job? Right? How will the children study if they have to work for a living? You know, how will the old people remember the Lord if they have to engage themselves in all these things? Right? And then, you know, cows are cows. You take care of the cows, you give milk. You don't take care, they don't give milk. You know, it's not that they have to give milk. Like that. You don't take care, they don't give. So the point is everybody is able to concentrate. So then the general persons who are taking care of the community, your general grihasthas and all that, who are supporting the children, the women, the Brahmins, the cows, you know, and the old people, then they must be protected by the leaders. know, by the administrative class. And the administrative class must be protected by the Brahmins. The Brahmins are protected by Krishna. So everybody is in that mood of service and protection. So if this is understood, then it works. So to protect means we have to be able to accept that protection. So we have to be able to follow. We follow, we can lead. If we can't follow, we can't lead. So you have a bunch of rowdy devotees, and they don't like the whoever's on the top. You can remove the top, put them in the place, and then, I mean, I learned that in seventh grade. There was a book called Animal Farm. The whole purpose of Animal Farm was to show that whoever it is, you take them out and put in the next batch of rabble-rousers, and you get the same thing. Right? So that's my point. I'm always amused is that devotees have so much faith in modern history, but no one studies the history then learns anything from it. Right? You look at any revolution and all that, the bourgeois goes to the top, doesn't get the results they want. They go to the masses, get them riled up. They throw out the leaders, and then they try to fit themselves in there, and then the people throw them out. Right? It's standard. It's just history. Right? And then after that, then you get a real heavy-handed manager come in. So one has to see that it's a matter of first we have to make ourselves proper followers. Then we can lead. Right? So if we're in a position of leadership, then we must understand that and develop that as we go along. I mean, we have to be practical. Yeah. Like that. But the point is this thing is unless we have qualities, then how we will protect. So if we have the qualities, we know these people need this, that. It's not sentimental, but it's according to what they actually require. Like the mother. Mother takes care of the child, gives what they need, but doesn't give more than what they need. Otherwise the child is spoiled. Right? The child requires a certain amount, you give that. So when they're young, that amount is more. So therefore they stay in the home. And then when they get older, then because of that tendency to be familiar and that tendency to spoil, the parents knowing that's not good, that's the weakness of the biological parental ras. Therefore, at one point, they turn them over to the teacher parental ras. Because then the teacher can deal with them in that rasa, but without spoiling them. So that's the system. Because the parents, the kid asked 10 million times, it's very hard to say no. But for the teacher, it's the scriptures say this, the authorities say this, we see like this. Therefore, you have to follow. And because you don't have the biological attachment, they have to be more conscious and more respectful. They just have to be. So it's a perfect system. Then after they're trained in that, then they can go back to the home and deal as a, you know, bona fide member of the society. They've been trained. But otherwise, you don't become a dynamic member of the society remaining in the home, generally. There has to be some training from outside. So now, if that's understood, then if we see, okay, Gurukuls aren't functioning, then we have to go, okay, rather than throw out the Gurukul, then why don't we make it work? I mean, looking around, we have Gurukuls failed. We have 30 Gurukuls in the movement, at least we had. They all used to have ashrams, now it's down to, I think, 3 of them have ashrams. So then, that means it didn't work. But no one minds that the ashrams are gone. They say, well, they didn't work. It's not practical. It didn't function. But you look around. How many marriages work? Has anybody come up? Has a GBC, proposal come up? Let's ban marriages. Everyone should remain celibate because the marriages aren't working. Has it ever come up? Has one person in ISKCON thought of that? Right? No. Why? Because we value marriage. So if we actually valued the Vedic system of education, then we would figure out, well, what's going wrong? I mean, marriages aren't working. We go out, we buy books, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, and this and that, and try to figure out what's going wrong. You know, we have our little, what do you do, you know, counselings and this and that, try to make it work. Because it's valued. So if we value the education, we'll try to figure out what went wrong that doesn't work. And generally, if you look at it, the children were not protected, right? So that principle of Vedic education was not done. They weren't protected. Therefore, it fell apart. So as Prabhupada says, if there's a cataract on the eye, you remove the cataract. You don't remove the eye. You know? Then you have baby in bath water. I mean, there's so many. It's been said again and again. But, whatever. Issues, how you say, are more tasty than duty. Duty is motive goodness, not very exciting. Right? Issues are motive passion, very exciting. So therefore, you know, life, especially Western life, is meant for excitement. So then it becomes difficult. Because otherwise, how do you keep excitement up? Can bring together, easiest way to bring together a bunch of people who can't work with each other is make a common enemy. Then they can work very nicely together. So then as soon as that enemy's gone, then they're faced with the reality of having to work together. So you either have to face up to working together or create a new enemy. So you go from one issue to the next issue to the next issue to the next issue. And that no one's ever satisfied. No one will be satisfied. It can't be. It's impossible. So one has to look at the complete picture. And that is understanding the Vedic culture. Because the Vedic culture deals with all this. Then it works very nicely. But one has to... And if that seems impractical, then, according to the Vedic system... then those who do feel it's practical are the ones that should take it up. And those who feel it's impractical should just follow. Otherwise, then, you know, the options are not that great. If the Western culture was the panacea for everything, then I would have my doubts, why is this room full of people? You know? I mean, as far as I know, most people join because they found the material world was a bit annoying. You know? They couldn't answer the questions, didn't seem to give any depth of relationships, of dealings, you know? Didn't have any proper goal. It was rough. So that's why we joined, right? Artha, Artarthi, Jigyasu. And then very few are jnanis, where they actually know Krishna, want to please Krishna, and therefore come. You know, so it's knowledge, wealth, or anxiety. Or the whole of it. Yes, Mati. Does that kind of deal with it to some degree? What? Wasn't too rough? Yes, Mati.
I know very little about Gurukul. I was just wondering that when for me this seems like the first place in the universe, this ashram, and I was wondering the relationship between the parents and the child when they send, like you said, then they turn over the child to the Gurukul parents and stuff like that. How do they? What is your experience with the children? How do they relate with the parents? And that it seems like the parents may, the children get a positive alternative because they establish a relationship with the Gurukul teacher like that, a loving relationship. But the parents, they may need that. You know, they got the child and they may... How do they get that their relationship?
They don't bother. They probably think it's a bug. It's a little short vision. It's okay. We just leave it alone. It's a very interesting, that's interesting. I've always heard it asked from the other side, and I appreciate the question. The principle is that you have, it's one rasa, just starting from, is that the parental rasa is one rasa, though it has different flavors, different aspects of it. You know, it's just like the king is seen like the father, like that. The king is seen like the father. So then that goes on. And but in the school is also, it's like the parents. Because the rasa, and one, if one is going on nicely, it nourishes the others. So when the children go to the gurukul, if the proper atmosphere is there, it actually nourishes their relationship with their parents. Even though they may not be with the parents, actually their relationship with their parents improves. Like that. We've seen that. Parents have commented that before the kids were, you know, more wild and more rough, they inattentive, not respectful, being in the school, then when they see the parents, they would deal with the parents in a much nicer way. And sometimes we would have the problem is then the kids would be so nice, the parents would get very attached and would keep them, because the reason they sent them to school is because they were getting so wild. And then they just kind of stopped their progress at that time, you know. So it's interesting. But it does nourish each other. For the parents, then, from what I see, what Prabhupada was expecting is then they start taking advantage of their association with each other as devotees, because they get more into hearing, chanting, and this taking advantage of association of others, and in this way kind of like increase the service and this and that. And then from having gone through this experience, then many times they're able to actually lead better. They can then give advice to other grihasthas because they've brought up children at least to that point. They can take care of newer devotees, younger devotees. I mean, in other words, they take on the other aspects, just like the child is experiencing other aspects of the parental rasa, they can take up other aspects of the parental rasa. Like that. It would be very common also, like amongst the Brahmins, is that the Brahmins would never, they would bring up their own child up to a point when they're ready for education, then they would go to the gurukul. And so you would see Bharadvaja's son would study with Raibya Muni, and Raibya Muni's son would study with Bharadvaja. You know, it's just, they knew, you can't bring up your own son if you want to bring him to a very high standard. If you just want to teach him an art, then you can bring them up, you know. But if you actually want to get them more than an art, you know, much, you know, deeper into the philosophy and understanding of culture, then at some point they should study under a teacher. Because in the house, the tendency is one is, the child is not observant. They take everything for granted. There's a place to stay, there's a place to sleep, something to eat. They just know if they walk in at this time, then they get something to eat, or there's something in the fridge, or there's something in the, you know, in the cookie jar, something. There's always something, and they don't even think. So all the philosophy the parents talk about, they don't observe it. Because they're just having a good time. But when they go to the gurukul, then the atmosphere is still parental, but because it's been taken out of that home situation, they must be observant about everything. And they must see. Then they start to see that the things that the parents had taught, here's the scriptures behind it, and they start to see, so they start to see with the vision of the scriptures, the Shastra Chakshus. Otherwise they don't see. So that parental, yeah. So then that brings out the actual going from the subconscious learning basically or you know, basics of that they've learned, you know, consciously from the parents, to it actually becomes externally very manifest in their understanding. It means they know why they're doing it. They connect it. Otherwise they just kind of do it like that. They just kind of do out of habit. But if there's no standard set, they may veer from that standard. They may change. So therefore, the training must be there. That's why Prabhupada says that it's considered Shudra if you don't go to the Gurukul. Like that. It means the Dwijas go to the Gurukul. Because then they learn the standards, so as they go through the life, they always have something to connect it to. Like that. So it's some way, it's some time. Even if it's a short time. You know? Prabhupada's even mentioning in Vrindavan, even the Delhi businessmen. They may send their children for some years only to learn philosophy and learn culture, you know, like that. But otherwise, they'll go back to the house, do business, and this and that and that. So it's, but the parents can take care, like the, especially, means the motherly rasa, the fatherly rasa of it, means can just be where one is taking care of anybody. Anyone who's junior, taking care, that creates the rasa. So the with the children, naturally there's that particular strong attachment, strong bond, but that also same thing can be done for others. So in the Vedic culture, from the very beginning, women are trained as mother. Like that, because then, you know, if it's alive, you know, you catch it and feed it. You know, it's just you take care, you nourish it in some way, whatever, by speaking, by dealing, by some way or another. And it can be appreciated, you know. That's why you see is the, it just works very, very nicely that way. And then one can apply that in so many situations. And I've seen, it's not a matter of age, it's a matter of, I've seen girls, when I came to India at 19, girls my own age or younger, and they would deal, like serving prasad and dealings when we'd stay in these life members' houses, just as their mothers, who were like in their 40s and stuff like that. The only difference was they weren't, you know, big and fat, you know, but otherwise their mood was exactly the same, like this. And this is, they're not married yet, you know, and so they already have that mood, they're trained in that. Then it's very nice, then it works very well. Otherwise, then they're always respected. Everybody has to respect their mother, you know. Lord Chaitanya, he took sannyas, but then his mother requested, you know, don't be so far away as Vrindavan. You go to Purushottam Kshetra. So he says here in Dvaita Prakash, he took the order on his head. It means he respects the mother. It means he can't go against Dharma. She was saying, oh, why you do this and that? So he explained to her what is the Dharma and what is the philosophy, and she accepted. Because it is true. Means the emotion must be balanced by the philosophy. The two must go together. So then it was very nice. So always respected, you know. The king always respects his mother. It doesn't mean she tells him how to run the country. But he's always respectful to her. So that means is that any man is always respectful to any woman. Like that. But that is made easy. This was brought up to Srila Prabhupada. You know, he mentioned this point, and the Brahmachari says, but the women don't act as mother, you know, they're out there trying to catch you and this and that, doing all kinds of stuff. He says, but, you know, one should endeavor. That's the process. So one should endeavor in that way. So in this way, then the girls are trained nicely, the boys are trained nicely, it works nice. So that motherly mood can be used basically in any situation. Like that. And different flavors. They all have different flavors. So it just gives opportunity. Then that. I don't know if that. Yes? What, where are you from? Ireland. But you're Irish? Oh, okay. No, but it's. Vedic thing. Okay. Interesting. Topic. Topic is what is, you know, what is the opinion on, you know, the, how you say, what, women's liberation or that more freedom and like that kind of thing. As Mataji mentioned, she finds it very bewildering. It is a bewildering thing because in the Vedic concept is that, let's see, it's a very big topic, you know. You can run a whole class just on that. But it's the basic principles we've been studying is there's a natural attitude or nature of the woman. It's just the way. It's just the makeup. There's just a difference, a mechanical difference between men and women and how they deal in all that. So now, the basic problem comes is when the women aren't protected, they need to be protected. So then if the men don't do it, then it's natural the women will want to do it themselves. like that. It's a natural next step. You know, just like if you don't take care of the children, they leave the home and take care of themselves. Like that. So basically it's come up from that. Men not performing their duties properly, then the women don't feel satisfied. Like that. But otherwise, it's the when you put so much emphasis on it, then it does bring in, it's cloaked under the thing that we're not the bodies, but the whole emphasis for it is because they're women. You have to give a class because you're a woman, you have to be a GBC because they're women, you have to be, right? It's just like the man's not giving the class because he's a man. No, he's supposed to give the class because he's supposed to know what he's talking about. You know, so we throw it into that realm, that's another thing. You know, those who know something have some realizations, they speak. But then it's whoever that is. So it's a... The difficulty comes is that, I say, the mechanically... Yeah. Means... I don't know how far you want to get into it. It's a very big topic. The mechanics of it. How it works. See, because the nature is there, and if that's cultivated as mother, then they're respectable by everybody. See, every woman is respectable by everybody in the community. Every man is not, just based on that principle. Then he is according to his status. You know, wealth or influence or power or devotion or all these things. But a woman is automatically just by being a woman. Like that. You'll see in India, they're very careful about this. It means those who are not so cultured may be a little wild. It means they, you know, sometimes girls may find some wildness from some of the local punks. But in their own community, they're much more careful. You know, just in their idea, Westerners are more wild, so then they try their luck being wild with them. I'm not sure how to proceed. We're not getting anywhere here. It's the main, yeah. I found most of the world is bewildered by this. But most of the world somehow or another doesn't, means generally the women that are bewildered by this aren't the ones on calm, you know, making big noise, you know, and having big meetings and all that. But I've been to many, many countries of the world, and they can't relate to it like that. Because they find is there's already more freedom and acceptance. Like I was noticing when I was in Europe, there's much more understanding that, you know, women have their interests and things that they like to do, and the men have theirs, and the men and women allow each other to do them. Like that, and so therefore the nature of controlling is less. So it's kind of each as individuals, they do their things that they like to do, and then life goes on much more nicely. Like that, you know. Also you find in India, it's seen much like the Brahmin women, they know so many things. Like that. But they do all those things just within their world. They don't try to move into the men's world and impress the men with it. They just do it in their world. They want to know music, they sing. They sing for their deities, they sing for each other. They don't bother that they have to be on the stage and sing in front of the men. So it's they know so many things. So it's just somehow or another seems to be specifically in you know, how do you say, certain first world countries, other than continental Europe, basically, of the first world, and then most of the rest of the world, you know, that's second or third world, they don't seem to have so much of a problem. So it's basically first world other than continental Europe. That the somehow or another the culture there somehow is a little bit more cramped. Also you can remove, I don't think there's as much problem in the cultures that are still left from the Celts. I mean, it's the original Europeans, you know, that means Ireland, Wales, Scotland, and Normandy. So basically if you cut it down, then you have a certain, those, the Anglo-Saxon countries, they generally have the main problem. So then then the culture there is somehow or another very bare, and the so much emphasis on controlling or enjoying or both. So the relationships aren't very deep. And then in this, unless they're doing something exactly together, they're not considering they're doing something together. You know? It's a very interesting thing. Like I've seen, I remember Indians or even the Chinese, like that, Asians. Let's say the family goes to the temple, right? The family goes to the temple. You know, you have the mother, father, and the three kids, okay? They all pile in the car. They're all excited. They're going to the temple together. As soon as they get to the temple, the man walks off one place, goes to, you know, hang out with whoever he is. The wife goes off, goes to the kitchen, and this and that. The kids go off to their different respective areas. They're there for, you know, so many hours of the Sunday feast, this, that. When the feast is over and that, and then in the evening time, like 8 o'clock, they all pile into the car and they go back. They haven't seen each other for the last, you know, 5 hours. And they pile back and they all talk about how they had a nice time together at the temple. Because they accept that each one has their own interests and they just like to do that. And that they're doing what they like at the temple. And for them, that is quality time together. But somehow in the Anglo-Saxon countries, it's like you have to be pushing the same button on the, you know, remote control on the television program together, you know, then you're doing quality time together or something. I don't know. It's funny. You know, it's like they have to do the same thing together, and then the problem comes is each one's different. And they want to do something different, so it all breaks up. What I've seen is basically all the other cultures of the world, it's understood, you know. Women like to do this, men like to do this, kids like to do this, boys this, girls that, and it's all facilitated. That's all within the realm of the house or within the community. And everybody's satisfied. And they consider that they're doing things together. You know? These older cultures... Basically, because these are older cultures, and these other ones are newer cultures, right? I mean, Australia is quite new, like that. It's only when the prisons got too full in England, then we had, you know, had Australia. England was just when you had enough madmen come in from Central Asia and wipe out the Celts, then they came across over to there. And then America, when they decided to, you know, they're having too much problem from the other... couldn't live with the other Anglo-Saxons, so they got in a boat and went to America. And when they got to America, they had to wipe out the Indians because they couldn't relate with them. You know, so very new cultures. There's no tradition. And they just somehow or another are emotionally very strained. Some areas, not so much, you know, like New England or some parts of the South, like that, some parts of the Midwest. There's a little bit more... generally because they kept European, continental European values and culture. So then they have a little less, more depth of interaction, like that. But otherwise it comes up just because the culture doesn't have any substance to it. And they don't have a system. There's absolutely no system of relating with each other. You know, Americans are very expert at getting together, but they don't know how to stay together. You know, like that. They're very ingenious of new ways of getting boys and girls together, but very difficult to. There's no science of keeping them together. You know? I mean, when you move out of the house at 18, it's very hard to learn about these things, especially you've been in school the whole time when you were younger. So, and mothers at work, fathers at work. So it's very difficult. You know? So that's where it comes from. So it's kind of those who have it, fine. But it's kind of like, you know, they feel like that and they can find other people to relate to that don't mind, fine. But it's the important thing is that one doesn't try to impose it on others. Like that. That's where the difficulty comes. Is when they impose it on others who you know, don't care. Like that. So basically it comes down to if the women, if they will train the children nicely, protect them nicely, then they'll grow up and they'll be able to protect the next generations nicely. But somehow or another, in these cultures, because the women haven't been protected nicely, then they're not able to protect the next generations. And then in this way, gradually, it just falls apart. You know? Okay. Like that. Yes.
Is it all about spiritual events and going to the teaching and training of the train ourselves? Are the mother to be in the temple to have that magic, the mother behavior, feelings? For myself, you know, I can't really try. Now I'm 40, so
yeah.
It's the things that, you know, in the beginning, it's never
You all hear? Mataji was asking, is that how to kind of like establish this? Is it by spiritual culture and spiritual understanding that it can be developed? You know, she was saying that just by age herself, she's found that it's starting to become more and more easy. But it's difficult when you're young because of the cultural experience you've grown up in. It's just, it screws you up too much. It's a big mess. You know? Especially the modern cultures that we see, it's women are very much exploited, and they don't mind because it's a matter of attention. Point is that the nature, the womanly nature, it requires a great amount of input, and that input is for a purpose. Just like we discussed before, the Vaishya by nature is greedy, and it has a purpose. So therefore, intelligent people allow that greed to work, do its work, though it can't. It has boundaries. But if they're not greedy, they won't make more money than what they need. If they don't make more money than what they need, then how will they pay tax, and how will they give in charity? So they have to always make more than what they need. Plus is then, how will they have facility for setting up the next generation? Right? Because they got to start their businesses or expand the business, so they must make more. So the same way as the women must absorb a huge amount of energy, because your kids take an immense amount of energy. Like that. You find that the men generally can't deal with the children on that degree of intensity that the women can. It's just, it's too intense. Too intense, too constant, you know. I was talking to Mataji the other day. She has 5 kids. So she hasn't had a peaceful, unbroken night's sleep in 11 years. Right? But she doesn't mind. You know, she keeps having more kids. If it really bothered her, she would have stopped after the first one. But it's just that because you can tolerate that. Prabhupada mentioned, it says the pain of childbirth, if the man experienced that, he would die. He said, factually, he would die. You know? That's why it's like when they do the studies, they see women are more tough and they have more tolerance, because they have to tolerate. Because the raising of children is very heavy. So during that experience, there must be a lot of energy coming in. Just like the Kshatriya, he's dealing with a lot of management. He also has things that relieve the mind. So the intensity of his administration has to be that intensity of relief. So in the same way as that intensity of sheltering the kids, one must receive shelter. You know, so a woman will only find much later in life than she can give more than she's taking. You know, in the beginning, she's just taking. And then in the middle, she's giving and taking simultaneously, and later than more giving. But it's necessary. Because otherwise if the kids don't get full attention, then they don't grow up to be complete people. And they can't give attention to others. They won't be leaders, because a leader means you have to give attention. This is a parental ras, you have to give. You know, so the mother's giving the child, father's giving some to the child, and a lot to the wife. So the leaders are giving then to their dependents. So unless one has received care, one can't give care. So that's why in the Vedic culture, women must be protected, because they bring up the children. If you don't, the children are the value of the next generation. Like that. But there's a point, there's a limit on how long they can do before. The girl, then they can take right through. But the boy, there's a cutoff point. If he doesn't go to the Gurukul, then he may get too absorbed in the home. and not become observant enough to develop the finer understandings. So there's a point. And it's seen that its limit happens automatically when the boys hit 11, 12, that's it. I mean, the mother loses the control on the kid. Then the father has to come in much more. But the point is made that when they, you know, because of puberty, then they get out of line. So it's mentioned that if it's known that a river will flood, then before the flood, you start putting up the embankment. Because if you try to do it at the time of the flood, then the embankment and the people trying to put it will be washed away. So therefore, if the kid just goes to the Gurukul just at that time of puberty, then, you know, the teachers and everybody will be wiped out. So they have to come earlier enough that the relationships are established, that you have the control, that you can get them through that period. You know, so therefore, there's a limit. And depending upon the child, the brahminical nature, they should go earlier. Kshatriya, they can go a touch later. Vaishya, a little bit later than that. But it shouldn't be too late, otherwise you can't get so much done. So the thing is if we understand what it is, we try to endeavor to follow it ourselves, and then the demand is made from the men. I mean, means the men are doing dressing and doing everything because that's what they feel pleases the women. So basically, whatever standards of Dharma that the women accept, that's many times what the men are following. Like that. If it's understood that the Brahmacharinis aren't going to marry a bozo Brahmachari, doesn't have any sense control or, you know, any like that, then boys will get serious. Like that. You know, if the women won't tolerate that the husbands don't behave properly, then they'll adjust. So if that's just known, then the culture starts to change. Then they put that into their children. They train their children like this. As I gave example of the other day. Something related.
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
I'm seeming to get understanding more when you stated that women require a lot more input. You gradually mentioned, but what do you mean by input?
Input, oh, details of input. Like that. It's like someone can feel they can do a service if the facilities for doing that service are like there and are guaranteed. You know, it's like if you have to, let's say, administrate an office, you know, you feel comfortable knowing that you can come back tomorrow, the office will be there, the desk will still be there, you know, the computer will be there, you'll still have a phone, you know, like that, and the people that are supposed to assist will also be there. But if you come back tomorrow and they decided, well, this desk we can use for something else, and, you know, all this and that, it makes it very hard to do the work. So they feel very comfortable when there is some security. You find the girls, one of the main things, I mean, other than getting out of the Brahmacharini ashram, is the security. Security, the steadiness. They just feel that those things are very valuable. So those are valuable because then that gives the steadiness to the children. So the children get to see a steady, regular environment according to their nature. You know, where the parents are satisfied. Then, in that, then he can relate to ideology. Right? Otherwise, so many times, you know, we'll be speaking what we're speaking now, and then so many times then someone will say, well, why don't we get real? But to me, in my experience, in my growing up, in my training, this is real. There's nothing more real than this, as far as culture goes. But in others, because they've never seen a steady situation, then to them it's not real. Right? So the kids get messed up because they don't actually understand emotion, exchange, you know, interdependency, working together, you know, how you say, you know, family unit or community unit. They don't understand respect. You know, there's just so many things they don't get. That people care for them. They're actually worried about their welfare. Therefore, then they can't care or worry about someone else's welfare. Like that. So, that you need the working environment. In other words, when the children are young, that's the home. There must be something, whatever it is, according to the nature of the individual. Something must be there. And, you know, Brahmins may require less than studying this so that the facility for that. Brahmins may be very simple, or others may be more. But whatever is the environment that they feel comfortable in to raise the child, that must be provided. That's why the Vedas always say that man and woman must be of similar nature, or equal nature. Because then the facility is the same. You know, a Brahmin is happy just to live in a very simple environment. But then his wife must also have the similar interest. She also is more interested in, you know, studying and puja and living simply. She doesn't want 5 million things herself. You know, her interest may be more than the man, right? Her needs may be a little more than the man, but it's still within the realm of brahminical needs. You know? So Vaishya may be more than that, but the man requires more and the woman requires more than that. You know, so like that you get that's one aspect. Second is you must feel that the support is there, is that the child, because the mother being the first guru, there's always a bit of familiarity there. So the father being the second guru, then there must be support that when the child gets too familiar, then the father is there to take care of that and to see and give that time to work it out. You know?
Disciplinary.
Yeah, the disciplinary, but from that same personal angle, you know, it must have that strong emotional input. You know, because then that matches and balances what the mother is giving. The mother's input will be a lot of emotion, and then good instruction. So the father's has to. We have the same. How you say? The principles must be the same, though the instruction may be the stronger, and then the emotion is backing it up. For the mother, the emotion is main, and the instructions back it up. For the father, the instruction is main, and the emotion backs it up. So like that. Then her as a person means being in dealing with the environment. Then this is where means they must. This is where it starts hitting all the shastric nerve points that are dug out by the feminists and or used by the men. It's used. These means the issues. Like Prabhupada mentions, women never develop emotional stability beyond a 12-year-old. So then if that is not there, how do you deal with a kid? Right?
If what's not
there. Huh?
If what's not there.
If they don't have that kind of emotional makeup. Means the man, as soon as the kid starts crying and freaking out, then it's kind of like he calls the mother and says, "Your child is crying." Right? Because he can't relate to it. But the woman can relate to it. It's within the realm, oh, they're crying, they're hungry, they're tired, they're this, they're that. And it's kind of part of the fun and culture to get involved in it and help the kid out. Right? So therefore, there are situations, especially that come from outside or even from inside the house, that become very difficult and unbearable. And then the man must help the woman get over that. When she freaks out, he has to give the time. You know, either other women are giving problem, or outside the house there's difficulties and like that, or the kids, you know, aren't behaving properly, or something like this, and it's more than what she can handle. So then the father has to be able to put in that time, like that. So it's very essential that element's there. This is taken and misused to say that. They have no intelligence, you know. But it doesn't say that. It's emotional, like that. You see, academically, women are as good or better than the men, like that, you know, like that. So when the Vedas are saying less intelligent, right? Probably the main nerve point. It's not meaning academic. It's not even meaning material. Right? We see women can be very, very expert at dealing with material energy. Sometimes they're more realistic than the men. Right? And the man decides, yeah, well, give up everything, move to Mayapur and this and that. And she says, wait a minute. You know, when we get there, where are we going to live? How are you going to maintain yourself? This and that. He goes, oh, yeah. You know, he'll just dive off into some ideal. And she goes, hey, wait a minute. Because materially, they're very intelligent. Academically, very intelligent. Memory can be very good. You know, like that. But what it means is because of that emotional state that is there for raising the children, then when it comes to choosing between matter and spirit, they know what is matter, know what is spirit, but because of the emotional pushing, it's sometimes hard to follow up on that, on the philosophical point, on what spirit. So that's why the man, this is the point where he is the gurupati. Because at that point, between his ability to establish, you know, choose what is proper, due to his, you know, training as controlled brahmachari and knowledgeable in the shastras, then that combined with the good intelligence of the wife, then she's able to make that decision. Does that make sense? Does that make any sense?
With good intelligence of wife?
In other words, she has good intelligence, but the emotional aspect is very strong. Right? Means, if you go into the mechanics of it, means they've done, you know, Americans are very good at this, because they're wondering why did the marriages fall apart. So then they started seeing what's going on and psychological and this, and they do all kinds of things. They found out women's and men's brain work differently. Right? You know, you have the right and left side of the brain, that. So one is more logic, one is more art, right? So then, for the men, one side works or the other. Neither both at once. You may switch back and forth quickly, but only one is working at a time. You're either being very logical, and then the women will say very, you know, the men are very cold and, you know, and all this, and not loving or caring. Or they're totally emotional and they don't think at all, right? Right, which means, right? Yeah. Okay. So then, but the women, both sides always work. So that means the logic is going on, but the emotions are always happening. So now, in both, this gives positive weak points and strong points. Means for the woman, both sides working at once means she can deal she can use her intelligence in the emotional field. So when you're dealing with kids are just, you know, a bunch of, you know, wild emotions and mind going all over. They can use their brain in this to figure it out. The kid is crying, you know, 100 to 1, the man can't figure out what's wrong, you know, but the woman can figure out, is he tired? Is he hungry? Did he wet his diapers? Is a bug biting him? You know, it's something like this. They can tell. Man can't tell at all. Because when he goes into the mood of emotion to deal with the kid, he can't use his brain. Right? And if he uses his brain, he won't deal with the kid. Right? Like that. So, something like that, then. You understand? So therefore, it's an advantage. That's what creates the motherly mood. So if that's cultivated in the girls, in the women, that's why they're always respected, because their mood is such that they're always mother. It doesn't matter who they are, they're going to deal in that. They have the quality of mother. You know, so within the emotional realm, trying to see what is the best. Right? You know, like you're inviting people over to the house, you know, so then, you know, the man will either look at it very, you know, okay, we'll put this one here and that and there, and she'll just calm down. Or, you know, yeah, we'll put this here and we'll put that there, and it doesn't have any flavor to it. So she'll say, listen, I'll do it. You know, we'll put this one here and that one will sit there and this, and we'll put this here and all these things. Because she'll work in both at once. Or the man's one or the other. Too dry or, you know, too crazy. You know? So then like this. So that's the strength. And then they're glorified like that. And it mentions in the Dharma Shastra, if you have a chaste woman and she's insulted, it can destroy a whole dynasty, not even just the person, the whole dynasty. Draupadi is insulted, it wipes out the whole Kuru dynasty, not just Duryodhana. It means everybody. Even Bhishma, Drona, everybody. Because she was chaste and she was insulted. Because she's mother. And mother can't be disrespected. Because you take mother, it goes back into the Lord's energy. You can't disrespect the Lord's energy and get the Lord, huh?
Heavy reaction.
Yeah, heavy reaction. But, you know, means when in general, if it's just a woman, then it may be small. If it's a chaste woman, then it wipes out much more. If she's not chaste, then you may just get the reaction yourself. But if she's chaste, then it can be very devastating. Because the principle of mother can't be disrespected. So that they must be trained in that. Then if you have But if you do it the opposite, she's not trained in that, then you get... See, the Bhagavatam glorifies the mother, the chaste wife, the Dharmapatni. And then the other scenario is the tigress. The tigress is she's for herself. Mother is she's working for others, serving others, pleasing others, nourishing others. Tigress is she nourishes herself. So then she uses her intelligence how to get what she wants. And then you get all the quotes, she'll kill her own children, her own husband, anybody to get what she wants. That's the tigress. So when we talk women's lib, we're talking the tigress. And when we're talking Vedic culture, we're talking the mother. And that's generally why the two women who work on these two different things, they can't relate to each other at all. Anything wild can't tolerate anything of the same species tamed. It means a wild animal meets a tamed animal of the same species, they'll always kill it. They can't tolerate it. Like that. Wild elephants meet tame elephants, they'll kill them. They can't tolerate it. It just doesn't relate to them. It's like, it's nonsense. So they can't tolerate that. So therefore the two can't relate to each other. Certain basic principles, of course, you know. But otherwise in general they can't relate. So everyone must respect. Then on the man, the strength is because he can work just in the analytical, he can just look at something analytically, no emotion. He decides, okay, we have to detach ourselves from this, can't do this thing. He can drop all emotion on what are the other considerations why I should do it. That gives him his strength. Therefore, he's the Guru Pati. And because the wife is trained as mother, she's the Dharma Patni. Means based on religion. And he's the Guru because he can lead. But if he falls onto the sensual side, then he doesn't use his brain. So then... that is where the Bhagavatam says the wife is the fortress. Right? The senses of the husband. Because he loses it and wants to get into sense gratification. She being fixed in Dharma and having both the emotional and logical, then his emotional she'll relate to with her emotional side, but she'll use her logic side to bring back the logic in the husband. Right? So that brings him back to normalcy. So that saves his son, therefore the fortress, right? And then what you had asked before, I was trying to explain why we got into this, was it's the opposite. When the wife gets too much on the emotional, and she knows what the logical is, but she can't do it because of the emotional, then his logical combined with hers can overpower her emotional, right? See, so it works, goes, whichever one's having the trouble, they help the other, like that. So that's the...
So therefore this situation that we have so much in this kind of the one thing is not a good, very bad.
Very bad. Means that, he was saying the situation we have with one parent is very difficult, yeah. But if not, if we know the science, then whoever the parent is there should try to make up for it. You know, means if it's the mother stuck with the kid, which generally is, then, you know, try to find other men in the community, this and that, that can give some input into the kid, like that. And the community itself then should take care, you know. I mean, it's just like, I'll give an example. This is a general example. You have a community, right? Let's say you have a community like in India, you know, a community of, you know, Marwaris or something. Then if one girl in the community loses her husband, right, and she has children, everybody in the community will chip in a little something, you know? Depends how big the community is, that small it is. You know, 5 rupees, 10 rupees. And then that can maintain. Then she can properly raise her children. You know, plus there's elders in the community. If there's problems, she can go to them. There's the other women in the community, so then fall back on that for helping take care of the kids. So in that way, it works very nicely. Right? Now it's that she's got to go out and get a job, and then the kids are left running wild, and then it drives everybody else in the community crazy. And then those wild kids then mess up other nice kids in the community, and then it's, you know. So it's just a matter of understanding that the mother and father aspects must be there in training the kids. So if the father himself can't do it, then that's got to expand to the greater father, you know, the community, like that. You know, but the grihastha should take care of the grihasthas. It shouldn't, as Prabhupada points out, shouldn't fall back to the guru or like that, you know, because he's for the spiritual father, not the material. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. Principle of?
The goal for the difference to separate the girls and the boys a bit to describe the nature. But in this kind of observing, one point doesn't deliver the students to that point. So they keep repeating that.
They keep mixing the boys and girls in the guru course. That's, if you don't know the science, then one does that. One knows the science. Just like I mentioned about boys' school, girls' school. Prabhupada says, you mentioned about a girls' school. Yeah, Prabhupada said, fine. He says, we were thinking of having another part of the community or another building, another place. And Prabhupada said, no, another city. Like that. It's girls thrive in the home, boys thrive in austerity. Means you bring the best out of the boys when there's austerity. You bring the best out of the girls when they're in a very congenial environment. Because they have to be able to create that for the children. And the boys have to do that because then it detaches them from the material nature. So when they deal in it, they can keep to that detachment. Because their idea is they have to help the wife get out and the kids get out. Right? Kids, when they're young, don't relate to big philosophy. So that means that motherly side has to be there to bring them up. But the fatherly point has to be there to bring them beyond that. You know? Fatherly aspect. So you have to have both. Means if one understands the science, then one can deal with it. Like that. It also depends upon the children. Like that. If the children are very innocent and all that, the parents are very innocent, then to a certain degree you can also mix the boys and girls. Like we see very early Gurukuls, boys and girls were mixed. It's not a problem. But basically, as soon as the first man from one family runs off with the wife from another family, that's when you have to start separating the kids. But as long as the community is innocent, then you can keep the children mixed up to, you know, like up to 10. Like that. With generally no problem. Boys and girls. But beyond that, it gets a little touchy. Very innocent, can go beyond 12, like that. Even 14. But nowadays, there's very few communities that are that innocent. So 10 would be the maximum, and better is younger. Even best is not at all. You know. But it just depends upon the situation. You know. I've seen new yatras. You can put 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old boys and girls together in the same kind of like, you know, youth Sunday class and this. No problems at all. Like that. But as time develops, you find you can't do that. So the best is the second. You know?
And then it's the good qualities that they themselves mix together with the others.
The Gurukulis themselves.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, that's very popular. It's called the, what is it? The Kunti Devi mentions that prayer. Thank you. Kunti Devi she's mentioning the river going to the ocean. Oh yeah, river going to the ocean. Like the mind and the young boys and young girls are naturally attracted to each other. It's very natural. So if somebody doesn't train them or control them, that's what will happen.
My question, where is something going wrong, either in the education or in the individual?
It's in the individuals because they haven't learned it from the teachers and their parents. Right? Like that. You know, like here. There's no ashram for girls here. So that means all the girls are living with their parents. So if you see the girls with the boys at the pizzeria, then that means the girls aren't trained. Right? And then the boys, they're not being trained nicely. Otherwise, they wouldn't use that as a forum. Right? Because the girls are foolish. It means anything you can catch. The basic principle is anything you can catch isn't worth getting. Right? Because that means then they're working on the principle of the senses. So the whole thing we've described, the use of the man in the man-woman relationship is that he's not controlled by the senses. And he can stay on that logical side, so when the wife is having difficulties, he can bring her across. But otherwise, then he won't be able to do that. So it's a very important point. So the women themselves don't do it, they don't train their daughters in that, and so that creates that point. You know? That's why in the Vedic system is the mothers are very strict with the daughters so that they would train and they wouldn't be out. You know? It's very natural. If you put something to eat out, someone who's hungry will come and eat it. So if you put girls out in the public, those who are untrained are naturally going to come. Like that. If you don't put the girls out, the untrained will just wander around. You know, find something else to do. You know, kill themselves wrestling or go to the Ganga or, you know, do some other stupid thing. If girls are there, naturally they'll go there. The question is what kind of role and training would the girls have if they had like a Brahmin or Kshatriya nature in previous, and then how would it be worked now? Basically, it means the general principle, all girls, then they would be trained, probably mentions, cooking, cleaning, all these different aspects in the house, dealing with the children, because there's children in the house, they'll deal with them. And they're dealing with their relatives or other children. So that aspect is there. So that's just the principle of womanly nature. You know, anything fine and anything like that. Then each woman is an individual. She has her own interests. So then accordingly, then scriptures and arts that are of interest to her, then she would generally study those things. The queens would generally know the most in arts because of the nature of the Kshatriya life. You know, you can see in the Krishna book all the arts Krishna learned. And you can see in the Brahma Samhita all the arts that Radharani and the gopis know. And they're very similar. Like that. So all these different fine things they would know. So the Kshatriyas would know more. And the higher they are in the level of the Kshatriya, you know, like emperors would know the most. Like that. And then lower kings might know a portion of it or this or that. So they would be very expert. Generally, the women would study, means those women with, means especially Kshatriyas and the Brahmins would learn all the subjects except for the memorization of the Vedic shlokas. It's just considered that because the Vedic shlokas, the women wouldn't chant them. and because that was all used in the ritual, and the men did the ritual like that. The women wouldn't do the ritual. So then they would learn all the other aspects of knowledge. Okay. So, yeah. And they would generally do that within their own, kind of like in their own house. She would sit in the back and hear and study the same studies, except for the Vedic mantras. Up to the age where she'd get married. Then at marriage, then she would concentrate on her household duties. And then if she, how do you say it? Had interested in study, when she had, she would do her own study like that. But otherwise, then once the children are grown up and when they go to the Gurukul, then she would get back into more study like that. So that would be generally the tradition for the modern boys and girls. And then the, how do you say? In the present, then these aspects are there, plus then ways that we can somehow or another be involved in the deity worship, you know, studying Bhagavatam, preaching in some way or another, but not at the expense if we have children of the children. The children always take the priority like that, because it's only a few years. A mother only has basically 5 to 8 years to really put into the child what the child has to know before the teacher takes them on, like that. And that's all. It's not a long time, you know, it goes quite quickly. So one must be, you know, concentrated on it. And then, you know, before the children, then they can be involved in so many other activities. And after the children go to the school, then so many activities. This is Prabhupada's idea. He was trying to present a very Brahminical kind of cultural aspect, is that the devotees were trained and were preaching and all this, then they could get married, and then they'd have, you know, after one or two children, like this, the children would go to the school, and then the husband and wife would concentrate more on studying and preaching and associating with other, you know, kind of older and mature devotees like that. It would be, yes.
I was wondering that I'm married to a preacher, and he told me just recently that he's distributing and preaching at universities, and he said that he's writing this book now about scientific evidence for Krishna consciousness, and he said, let's make the front cover in this way, because I will anyway mainly distribute to men. And then we were discussing this a little, and so he said he feels more protected if he mainly approaches men and distributes men. And then I was wondering, because I will distribute together with him, and should I focus on, is that an individual thing, you know? I just wanted to ask you, because is that also this principle that one should be like a lamb at home and like a lion outside, and how do you...
Yeah, it means it's the element of, yeah. In other words, one has to understand the different situations, there are different ways one behaves. There's not just one way one behaves all the time. One is considered like mature and trained, that in so many situations one can deal in so many different ways. Like that. So then, if you're dealing with, you know, if you go out and you preach and go to the universities, then you deal basically, you know, whatever has to be said and done to get the work done. But one must always remember that still we have that respect and mood of how you say, following to the husband. So it may be with other men, because, you know, we're dealing with them and they don't know, they're untrained, uncultured and all that. One, we have to, you know, protect ourselves, and the second is that we may have to, you know, say so many things. But then we must always remember in the house, because that's the whole thing, is the in the house, the man is looking for that gentleness in the house. If he needs roughness, he can stay out with the men. But he's looking for the gentleness in the house. So if he doesn't find it in the house, you generally see they leave the house. That's why in the Vedic culture you see the marriages last so long, because the women would always be gentle in the house. Even if they have something they want to get done or something to say, they will say it in a gentle way. And they'll be patient know? That's why it says patience is one of the feminine qualities mentioned in the Gita. Is that, you know, the man is kind of like, he has an idea now, wants to do it now. The woman comes up with the idea, presents it. If it flies, great. If it doesn't, then she'll bring it up. She'll wait for the next situation. The sensitivity is there. When the right situation, bring it up then, or wait and then hear, and she'll eventually get it. So that patience is one, that's why it's glorified as a good quality. And this way, then the man feels that softness of the home. Otherwise, just outside is very, it's more harsh. So that's the in other words, the opposites are attracted by the opposite quality. And the woman is gentle, fine like that, and appreciates the strength of the man. But he also has to be gentle. Means, how you say? Gentle power. You know, or power that's controlled power is then appreciated, because the woman, you know, the mind goes and so many things go, the emotions are going, so that fixedness of the man is a comfort. While for the man, you know, he's dealing in the harshness and all that, he the comfort he gets is the softness, the fineness of the woman. So if these are there, then it works nicely. If it's not there, then we find it's a difficulty. Therefore, we see so much problem, like in America or England, you know, the women are very strong, the men are very weak, so neither is satisfied. Neither find the qualities that they're looking for, like that. So then, but it, how do you say? But Prabhupada mentions that the key of it is actually with the woman. Because if she behaves gently, it generally always brings out strength in the man. You know, it's just like men will be there, they'll be slobs hanging out with each other and that, and they're just hanging around. And the woman walks into the room, they all kind of like sit up and worry about the hair a little bit and check this and that, and like that. So the whole thing is the woman deals gently, then if the guy's not totally untrained, it will invoke from him the how you say, more the manly mood, protective mood, all this. If he's badly trained, then he may exploit the situation. That's why one should be very careful to see what one marries. You know, like that. But it can be invoked from that side. You know, we were discussing, I think, I don't know if we discussed it here yesterday, I can't remember, because this is, we have the main class, we have the questions after the class, and in the early morning I have another class with someone else, so then the story of the Beauty and the Beast, right? I don't know. I don't know where it's from, but it's one of these. You know, Beauty and the Beast. Ever heard of it? It's an old one of these old kind of, you know, like Jack and the Beanstalk. It's like one of those ones. But there's some really, I don't know what it is. It's some kind of not very pleasant person. You know, very rough, ugly, nasty. No one deals with him. Fights with everybody, and somehow or another comes in contact with a very, you know, beautiful, refined girl, and so she somehow or another tames him. So he starts to behave much nicer, you know. So the whole thing is that can be done, but one has to have the tolerance and everything to do it, you know, and the patience, you know, like that. Then it works. But otherwise, then, you know, do it. Because, I mean, it's, otherwise, how long is it? It's a drop in the bucket in time, you know? 10 years, 15, 20 years, you know? You know what I'm saying? Is that tolerating certain things that are, you know, rough, out of the way, not so... It just... One goes through it, it works nicely, you know? Kids grow up nicely, husband and wife, you know, get over the... How you say? Understand that this is not where the substance is. You know, the substance is in the devotional service. Does that make sense? Like that. And that makes things, yeah, it makes things nice.
This protection that he said that he can be agitated, it depends on the late, you know.
Can be.
Is,
yeah.
Is that, you know, I think you know better, my friend, you know?
No, you're saying for the opposite means for yourself?
Yes,
Oh, I see. You have to be careful. It means that when the motherly mood is there, then it's kind of like anything that comes along, doesn't matter how old it is, just that, you just deal in that way. But if that's not very developed, then one must be very careful. Does that make sense? Like you have a, you know, it's like, you know, you have the leader of a country. And if he goes home to visit his mother, then she's still telling him about his health and, you know, are you eating nicely and, you know, staying up too late at night at all these meetings and, you know, why don't you slow down and take care of yourself and watch your diet and, you know, this and that. And, you know, and he's kind of, you know, thinking, like, come on, you know, I'm managing this whole country, you know, give me a break, Ma, you know. Like that, because it's just that motherly mood is there. It doesn't really matter. So if that's developed, then one can deal. And if you find that the elements are such that the men don't respect that, then those areas generally one would avoid. The men can deal respectfully and properly, then you can deal in that environment. But if they can't be, then, you know, unless you have a good, you know, right hook or something like that, then one has to avoid it. We had one lady here, Mayapur. She used to go out and big collector. She would distribute. One of the main places she'd go was to the bars, right? And then, you know, sometimes the men would be a little too drunk and they would, you know, try to catch her, you know? She'd just turn around and floor the guy. Floor him. She'd just, you know, bang, you know, the guy. And then she'd just walk off, you know? So, you know, they didn't mess with her. But she has a very rough nature. The funny thing is now she's like started to take up that the more, you know, feminine qualities. She can't go out and collect them. She can't do it, because before she'd just go out there and move around, and she was tough, very tough. She was big collector. Now she just can't do it. You know, she's become very gentle and all that kind of thing. So you have to see the environment, what you can work in. You know, otherwise you preach to the ladies, you can preach to the men. And sometimes you have very innocent men or this and that, and they preach, it's no problem. Like that. But if it is a problem, then avoid them. Avoid them. Or work as a team, or, you know, whatever. Whatever's comfortable, whatever's best. Yeah. One can use all of that. One has to be very careful about astrology, how expert someone is in reading it and understanding it and that, because it's unless it's very well known, it can be dangerous, you know, like that. Some things can be, you know, certain planets go with different things, but then it's also within. Like, you know, you have Brahmins and they, all subjects is can be one of their theories. You know, like cows is also part of Ayurveda. So they can have a great knowledge, you know, like they're interested in cows, but from the medicinal point of view, and from that way they enter into it and take care of the cows. You know, or here it's just, you know, it's a hobby, like cows, or in your house you'd like to have a cow. That doesn't mean you're a Vaishya, because before everybody had a cow, you know. So having one cow, taking care of a cow, and this and that, that's doesn't necessarily make one a Vaishya, you know. Like that, management, it just depends upon how big is the management, you know, because generally it's within the house, the wife has the reign of the house, so she would manage the house. So depending upon her nature, that's how big or how small it is. Or within the realm of, you know, the Ayurveda and things like that, you may then in this way then get involved and manage a lot of cows. Or you're into education, but then you manage the education. You understand? So it can be combined in many ways. So you have to basically see what's the emphasis. Is the emphasis in this is kind of like, kind of what you get back from it, you know? Like that can be seen and appreciated by others? Or is it just the influence and not that kind of just moving the material energy? Or is it actually just the knowledge and moving in that sphere of knowledge, having that sphere to move in, whether anyone else appreciates it or not? You know, that's another thing. You know, or others can appreciate that you're a pandit, but it's more for the appreciation that you're a pandit rather than the facilities you get from that. You have to also see those subtle things. So it's a matter of just working with it and seeing what you're comfortable in. You know, it means try them. You know, try education, move in that way. And, you know, if you think that there's these three, go for the top one, because that's more the mode of goodness. It'll be most quickly obvious that it's not the one. If it is, that'll be happy. If it's not, then... And then one adjusts these things, you know. So one may run a school in which you have some cows. You know, like that. You just have to find where it... What is occupation and what is hobby? That's the thing. You know, Kshatriya is also expert at music. But that's their hobby, it's not their occupation. Like that. Does that make some sense? Okay. Yes.
What went wrong with Gurukuls?
I'm sure that there's so many factors of what went wrong with Gurukuls, but just basically from my experiences is a lack of dealing with the individuals and a lack of trying to shelter the children. That's the main. Because is that everybody has an individual nature and that must be recognized. And then accordingly then you train the individual. Like that. That is there. And then that shelter, that it's understanding that it's a parental rasa. So therefore the care is there, but you don't have the biological attachment. Like that. So that is important. If those aren't there, then everything else falls apart.
Like a trained, qualified teacher.
Yeah, generally we look at now trained, qualified means that they know how to teach academics. So that's all right for the academic teacher, but that makes a school. And if somebody knows good administration, you put the two together, you have a school. But a gurukul means that you know the parental ras, and you psychologically know nature, and you know varnashram. So then you know how to work with that and put them into their different places. So that would be a major difficulty. Parents also... Kids weren't trained. Parents, many didn't support the schools. You know, teachers, they were, in the beginning, were many times just who was not good for anything else. Couldn't manage the temple, weren't good at, you know, collecting money or book distribution, or couldn't manage anything else, so therefore let's try them in the gurukul. So like that, then you end up with, then it becomes very difficult. Very difficult. Then you have to see that easiest thing is one is if you can find second generation, first generation understand this, involve them in it. Otherwise, easier probably is to involve second generation who have some understanding of this and let them. By nature, they're always going to care a little bit more for the kids, but not necessarily that they understand the varnashram and how it works. That is that. But that's important, you know, because culture, like we mentioned before, business comes from business, you know. So, like one businessman can train another one. So same ways as you have to get the culture from the culture. Like that. So Prabhupada gives all the points in this book, so we have to train according to that. Then it works nice. Does that make some sense? Yes.
You mentioned before two types of gurukul boys. One who came early and stay long, and the older who are short in gurukul and in their education.
Yeah. It means means that generally the Brahmins, because they had to get both their theoretical and practical knowledge in the Gurukul, they would have to come the earliest and stay the longest. Kshatriyas then a little less than that. They get all the theory there and the principles of their practical, but then they would have to actually practice it outside. And then for the Vaishya, then they get their philosophy and culture from there, but no business theory or anything from there. And then so they would stay shorter. And then the Shudra is shorter than that. They would just basically get the Shastra and connection. The generally means the philosophy and the how their subject connects to the Lord, and that's it. That would be generally what's there. So it's just a matter of how much time. Because before it was by the time they were 16 or 18. Then they could leave the Gurukul and go out and start working. Start getting involved, the businessmen and the Kshatriyas, like Abhimanyu. He was 16. So he had finished his education, he was married, and he was on the battlefield. And he was not any less than anyone else. It took 7 Maharatis to kill him. And that by only using devious means. So they're qualified. But the Brahmins would stay longer than that. Because then, see, it's basically around 16, 14, but especially at 16, that's when you can really start to understand fine points of philosophy. Unless someone's very qualified, but generally that's the natural age. So then for the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, like that, that wasn't so important. If they could get it, that's great. But at least they would have gotten all the theory of the philosophy. But the deep realization, they could get that because both of them continue their study. Both of them always are doing sacrifices, hearing from Brahmins, like that. So then it would deepen, But they get restless at that age. They want to do practical. So by doing their practical duties and the study, then they'll get more realization. But for the Brahmin, then he can get into the fine points of knowledge after 16. So then they stay however long it takes for them to study whatever they want to study. It would be very individual. However far they can go and however many subjects. Like that. So some will go more, some less. Like that.
I think for the success of the Gurukul, the pre-Gurukul period, that is with the mother, and even after the Gurukul, even these things have to be working quite well.
Yes, they have to be working quite well. It means they're not working. It's just like this. Give example is that if I bring gold ore to a goldsmith and tell him to make nice ornaments, it won't be possible. But if I gave him already refined gold, then he can make that into an ornament. So it just depends upon what you want from the school. If you want them to just take the animal and make him into, a semi-human, then you don't have to do much training at the house, right? If you want to take, basically potential human child and make him into a cultured person, then he has to come already human. And if you want to make them into acharya, they already have to come as a devotee. So it's just what you want. But unfortunately, many times the parents, the kid's wild today, they give him to the Gurukul, they expect tomorrow that he'll be a saintly person. It doesn't really work like that. They may calm down a bit, but not that much. It means you can, if they start here, then the school can get them to here. Right? So if you bring the kid here, they may get him up to here. You bring the kid here, they can get him to here. So like that. So it's just a matter of what comes to the school, then you can refine that. So if they come as an animal, you can refine that maybe to a human. If they come as a human, you can refine that into a devotee. If they come as a very nice devotee, you can refine that into an advanced devotee. So it's just a matter of what. So the different schools should be established for different kinds of children. You know.
Even after the Gurukul is finished education, it's like a big question mark. What next? So they don't fit into the regular temple atmosphere in ISKCON. After they go out and work and like little.
Yeah, I mean we haven't had that so much that problem here. I mean, our kids come out of here, either get into the temples or they go out there and make big bucks. You know, they don't really seem to have. I don't know that we have any kind of like wastrels wandering around. Other schools have had a lot of problem with that, but not so much from here. Like that.
What is the reason?
What is the reason? Generally because we would bring out their individuality, which makes it very tough on teachers. Because then in the classroom you have 10 individuals rather than 10 square pegs to stick in the square hole. So that's why, for myself, I only manage this much. Because then we can deal with, it's focused only these kids that have this nature. Because to do a broad nature, you have to have good administrative abilities. Right. So someone who has the knowledge and the administrative abilities or has other administrators to work with can run a much broader range on a gurukul. But here we just work within the scope of what we can deal with. So that's the main thing, is just dealing with the individuals and understanding you have a standard which way to send them. Also, we put a lot of emphasis on service. So therefore, boys that would come out of here, if they go to a temple, even if they ran at 50% service attitude, they would generally be their best brahmacharis. You know? Or if they want to get into business, they have no problem working. They don't mind working and endeavoring. Like that. I like that.
Is this staying till 25? Is this a figure which is fixed like that? Or?
Staying to 25. This Prabhupada recommends it. The 5 to 25, generally, because that's at the age the body becomes the strongest. According to Ayurveda, the man's body is the strongest at 25. So then there's the best chance that the child will be a male. Because it's always recommend the first child, it's best that it's a boy. Because then that boy can take care of the mother, can do so many different things. Before that, then the body is not as strong like that. That's one aspect. The other aspect is that if you want to study very nicely the philosophy and all that, then one would stay later up to there. So Prabhupada was expecting to have people, you know, he's talking about leaders and all this, so they should be well studied in the shastra, the culture, and everything like that. You know, and the age of 5 means that's the earliest time. If you're very serious about spiritual, then that's the recommendation. Like that.
Is it still for men and women, 25 years?
No, that's for the men. The women mature much quicker. Like you'll see, a 9-year-old girl can chant 16 rounds, no problem. Attend the program, be very serious. A boy at 9, not so easy. You know, basically speaking, is certain aspects of the mentalities move along the same, certain aspects of the ages, but otherwise a girl at 12 is a woman. A boy just doesn't really get serious till many, many years later. So there's always a difference of age. Like that, it's always better. Otherwise, means maybe spiritually, if they're equal age, they may have the same academic ability, but the girl actually is more mature on the material platform. So her material sophistication will be more than the boy, and that'll be a problem. So when the Vedas say the nature should be equal, it should be equal. So you have to find that age in which they are equal.
But in Vedic system, also parents define if they have a boy, they find a woman for this boy. They see the boy is not chosen what they want.
Yeah, no, we discussed that all, I think, yesterday a lot. I mean, the point is someone who has the interest of the persons in mind, the boy or the girl, they must make the arrangements. Because otherwise for the boy and girl it's very difficult.
But now we go in Kali's time phase, it seems to the young people settle on to make the choice now.
Yeah, means young people want to make the choice. Why not? They can go for it. Doesn't mean that that's
but
the best thing.
But in this kind of Krishna consciousness, so the right spirit cannot hold on. What if they start to make their own choice there, what is the rules and regulations from this kind about that side?
I don't think there are any specific. I think it's more laissez-faire right now. Means the Vedic standard is someone who is the well-wisher of each party. Then they look for somebody who's compatible. And only after finding some compatible persons, then they may be introduced. Because otherwise, then what is their training how to make a choice? What is their training? Because unless you train in the Vedic culture, Western doesn't have a training for it. Is there a training for the marriage, what to look for, how to judge this and that. Basically, the training is if they look nice, right? I mean, that's at least, you know, that's what I grew up in. Girl looks nice, the boy looks nice, that's the one you want to marry. You know, and if you're a little bit more clever, then you look and see if they're rich. You know. Like that, but otherwise, you know, it's not a lot of training. So simply, it's just, you know, my hormones get very attracted by this person. That's the standard. And then when those hormones stop working, then there's divorce. You know, so it's a simple process. It works if they don't mind it. That's all. But the problem is it's okay if they're not having children. The men and women just want to keep going on and on and on and getting married, divorce, it's all right. But as long as they don't have any children. As soon as they have children, the children get affected by that. Children don't understand these things, you know. Mommy doesn't go away. You don't end up with a new daddy, you know. It's just they don't relate to it. They'll accept it. But it does something to them, you know. You know, it's one thing if the mother dies and then there's a new mother, the children accept that readily because all women are mother. But father, they're ones a little bit more particular about, especially girls. Very difficult to you know, reintroduce a new father. You know, because the girls, they're smart. They know why the mother's getting married, and so then they know that this man is not interested in protecting them. This man is interested in their mother. This is their mother's boyfriend. This is not their shelter. So it's difficult.
Hey, Maharaj?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
Are you going to take Prasadam at 2:30?
That's the normal time it should be. Why? Okay. You want to eat then, or you don't want to eat?
I was going to arrange that we take Prasadam together in my place, because I wanted to talk with you.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted.
Yeah, yeah. No, 2:30. Okay. So I think maybe if there's anything else, otherwise we'll end now. Yes.
Just saw the item from yesterday. I already covered. What is the view of the temple president and the spiritual master
in arranging marriages?
Yeah.
The duty of the temple president, the spiritual master, in arranging marriages. Well, a spiritual master is about zero. And the temple president, as one devotee mentioned yesterday, it's ideal. I mean, it depends upon what you have. Point is, if there's no community, then the temple authority is kind of, it falls on them if they're living in the temple. then the temple authority should see that only those who can work within that framework live in the temple. And if not, then if they're living outside, they'll naturally take care of themselves. But then they should be looking at it, what is best for these people, not what is best necessarily for the temple. You know? It means the temple management. You know? Because the thing is that if you manage the people nicely, you'll naturally have a nice temple. The devotees are satisfied, then according to the proper standards, then the temple will run nicely according to the standards. So the, you know, like that you have to see. If you have a community, then better others in the community. It can be the president, can be others. It's whoever has abilities and understandings. You know, and it's also good those who know the people are involved. You know, someone who's a well-wisher, like that, they're involved. Okay, is that okay? So we'll end now. Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.